Alexis Grigoropoulos was spending time at the cafe with his other friends. Alexis, being 15 years old, thought it would be fun to throw a bottle of water at a cop car. This was the last bit of fun Alexis Grigoropoulos would ever have. The cop came out of his car and said to the boy, and I quote, "Now you will see what I am going to do." Drew his gun and ended Alexis's life at the age of 15.
This week in Radical History for the week starting November 15th is dedicated to all my sisters and brothers on the streets in Greece and to Alexis.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in Radical History for November 15th, for all the heaviness in the air, we'll start out this week on the lighter side. For an 1869 San Francisco land speculator, Norton I, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, leaves San Francisco to seek his yearly tribute from the legislature and the lobbyists. He inspects the new capital during the gala ball celebration and the building's inauguration. 10 years earlier, he had made himself Emperor of the United States and made the following edict abolishing the Congress. Quote, "It is represented to us that the universal suffrage, as now existing through the Union, is abused, that fraud and corruption prevent a fair and proper expression of the public voice, that open violation of laws are constantly occurring, caused by mobs, parties, factions, and undue influence in political sects, that the citizens have not the protection of their persons and property which he is entitled to by paying his pro rata of the expense of government, in consequence of which we do hereby abolish Congress, and it is therefore abolished. And we order and desire the representatives of all parties interested to appear at the Music Hall of this city on the 1st of February next, and then and there take the most efficient steps to remedy the evil complained of." Unquote. Official government census records of the time list Norton I as emperor. Sorry, Brock, I cannot recognize your rogue government authority. Also on November 15th, 1890, Sioux Chief Sitting Bull Tatanka Iotake is murdered in South Dakota by the police as he stepped from his cabin to submit to being arrested. He was unarmed. Also on that date in 1916, Dr. Ben Reitman is again arrested for distributing illegal birth control literature at one of Emma Goldman's lectures in New York. Also on November 15th, 1921, Jacob Abrams, along with hundreds of other radicals, are deported and arrive in Moscow, victims of the Red Scare in America. They find that Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, who were deported, had already departed for the West, disillusioned with the turn of Russian Revolution had taken. Abrams was deported for handing out literature denouncing the U.S. invasion of Russia. The resulting Abrams case, as has become the known, is landmark in the repression of civil liberties, cited in all standard histories as one of the most flagrant violations of constitutional rights during a Red Scare hysteria. Also on this date in 1936, George Orwell dispatches his manuscript of The Road of Wigan Pier, which is to be published about his growing up in the working class of England, and leaves for the revolution in Spain. Quoting Orwell as he remembers his arrival in Spain to fight the fascist, quote, "This was in late December 1936. The anarchists were still in vital control of Catalonia, and the revolution was still in full swing. When one came straight from England, the aspect of Barcelona was something startling and overwhelming. It was the first time that I'd ever been in a town where the working class was in the saddle." Unquote. George Orwell. Also on this date in 1953, U.S. veteran James Kutcher, who lost both his legs in World War II, was informed that his disability payments are being cut off due to his membership in the Socialist Workers' Party. This in America, land of free, first they come for your legs, then your food. Also on this date in 1966, animator, union hater, and fascist sympathizer Walt Disney dies. More news on November 15, 1969, in Italy. Anarchist railroad worker Pinelli, secretary of the anarchist Black Cross, is tossed through a four-story window to his death at a police station. Pinelli and others who were also arrested, following the anti-anarchist hysteria orchestrated by the government and press, is accused of the bombing in Milan. Only much, much later is revealed that the bombing was a work of right-wing fascists, in collusion with the government reactionaries. How little things have changed in Europe as thugs who carry guns to this day. As then, as in today. Quote,
"Now you will see what I am going to do." Drew his gun and ended Alexis's life at the age of 15. The shooting of young Alexis sent a shockwave through the streets of Athens, Greece that day. The next day, following the state's failed reports to cover up the story, claiming that the bullet was a ricochet off of a wall, despite the many eyewitnesses' reports, The people of Athens quickly armed themselves and took to the street in an insurrection. 6 days later, this insurrection has spread throughout Europe, affecting parts of Spain, London, France, Italy, and even going into Turkey, where the prison system and police brutality is far beyond what we understand in the United States of America.
That was an awesome report by the new radio program called Anarchy Now, which can be found at the same place you find this show each and every week at radioforall.net. You'll hear 2 more minutes of this Anarchy Now at the end of the show. Now back to the busy November 15th in 1969, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, reaffirms its biblically ordained the need to exclude blacks from the ministry. Also November 15th, 1970, the Nez Perce Tribe of Idaho and Confederated Tribes of Washington win $1.1 million for the loss of tribal land stolen in the 19th century. Also on that date, 1982, United Nations General Assembly calls for nuclear weapons freezes. Of course, the United States objects. To quote Eisenhower, "I think people want peace so much that one of these days, government had better get out of their way and let them have it." This week in radical history for December 16th, 1773, the first WTO protest, Boston Tea Party, blatant terrorism and violation of property rights. It glorifies the destruction of property by vandals and inspires the Eugene anarchists during the WTO protest in Seattle over 200 years later in 1999. Also on December 16, 1913, despite warnings by Paterson, New Jersey police forbidding Emma Goldman from speaking, she addresses members of the IWW anyway on the speech, quote, "The Spirit of Anarchism and Labor Struggle," unquote. Emma is forced off the platform. Audience members engage in battles with cops to release her, just like a rock star. Kurt Vonnegut once wrote, quote, "Labor history in the U.S. is treated like pornography," unquote. Only a couple more items for December 16, 1983. A journalist checking into citations of all 434 Congressional Medal of Honor winners awarded during World War II reveals that not one of them matches the story acting President Ronald Reagan told the other day. The journalists conclude, "It didn't happen. It's a Reagan story." The President of the United States went before an audience of 300 real Congressional Medal of Honor winners and told them about a make-believe Medal of Honor winner. Responding, Reagan's spokesman said, quote, "If he tells the same story 5 times, it's true," unquote. Also on December 16, 1991 in Canada, Indian Affairs Minister announces final agreement with the Inuit of Eastern Arctic, creating a new Native-run territory. When details are worked out 3 years later, it develops that natives will only be in control of land deemed not to be in commercial value or military value to the Canadian government. Yeah, that iceberg over there, that's yours. Lastly, in 2000, John Loftus, former prosecutor in the Justice Department Nazi's War Criminal Unit, said Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a principal in Union Banking Corporation in the late 1930s and 1940s. That bank was liquidated in 1951, and Bush's grandfather and great-grandfather received $1.5 million as part of the dissolution. That money flows into American politics today. Loftus says, quote, "That's where the Bush family fortune come from. It came from the Third Reich," unquote. This week in radical history for December 17th, only got a couple items. 1526, Pope Clement VII forms the Inquisition.
Years of the 16th century, to combat the rising tide of religious unorthodoxy, the Pope gave Cardinal Jimenez of Spain leave to move without let or hindrance throughout the land in a reign of violence, terror, and torture that makes a smashing film. This was the Spanish Inquisition.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
I know.
In addition to the Spanish Inquisition, on 1936 in Moscow, Pravda announces that, quote, "As for Catalonia, the purging of Trotsky's and anarcho-syndicalists' elements has begun. This work will be carried out with the same energy that which was done in the USSR," unquote. Lastly, in 1966, against the U.S. wishes, UN General Assembly approves an international treaty banning nuclear weapons in space. This week in radical history for December 18th, only a few items. More Greece news in 236 B.C. Possibly the first recorded union organizing happened with gay flute players at the Temple of Dionysus in Athens put down their tools and refused to work until their food improves. also on December 18, 1865, with the ratification of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it ensures that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States. Slave wages, on the other hand, still okay. Also on December 18, 1905, labor activist Eugene Debs talks about the cult of personality, a message to all Obama supporters here. Quote, "Too long have the workers of the world waited for some Moses to lead them out of bondage. I would not lead you out of it if I could, for if you could be led out, you could be led back in again. I would have you make up your own minds. There is nothing you cannot do for yourselves." Unquote, Eugene Debs. Also on that date, 1946, black right activist Steve Biko lives, South African leader of the Black Conscientious Movement, murdered by South African police in 1977. Lastly, on this date in 1972, war criminal Henry Kissinger's statement on 26 October that peace is at hand as U.S. launches heaviest air bombardment of the entire Indochina war against North Vietnam. As places like the Bac Mai public hospital is bombed, nothing is spared, not even on Christmas. As Nixon orders his soldiers to practice goodwill towards others and orders the Air Force to deliver Willie Pete on top of innocent civilians. This week in radical history for December 19, 1842, the U.S. government recognizes the independence of Hawaii. However, 55 years later, the U.S. unilaterally annexes Hawaii. Gee, make up your minds, will ya? Also on December 19, 1875, black educator, historian Carter Woodson lives, founder of the Negro History Week, which would evolve into the Black History Month recognized today. Also on December 19, 1902, starring on a slot of this, Valternine D. Clear is shot by an insane former student. One of Philadelphia's best-known anarchist orators, Clear was a Philadelphia teacher, an atheist, free speaker, feminist, and anarchist. She made many, many lecture tours, including Europe, and was known in the international movement for her many essays and poems. Hit by three bullets while waiting on a trolley, she'd be treated by Daniel Moldo, a general practitioner who was also an anarchist. She earned a lasting respect for both her anarchist friends and the general public by her refusal to testify against her assailant, who was a familiar face in the anarchist scene. This week in radical history for December 20th, only have three items. 1835, Cherokee Indians forced to cede their Georgia lands and cross the Mississippi River when gold was discovered on their territory. The evacuation was carried out during the winter of 1838 and 1839 by federal troops. Along the way, over 10% of the tribe was wiped out by disease, fatigue, and exposure. The march hence was known as the Trail of Tears. Also on December 20th, 1917, Emma Goldman meets with Helen Keller during the month at a benefit ball for the masses. Most of the people working for the masses, such as Dorothy Day, John Reed, Floyd Dell, and Art Young, as many others, believe that World War I was caused by an imperialist, competitive system, and the U.S. should remain neutral. When the U.S. declared war on the Central Powers in 1917, the masses came under government pressure to change its policies. Refusing to do so, the journal lost its mailing privileges. Then it was prosecuted under the Espionage Act, forcing the paper to cease publication. Let freedom ring. More freedom news on December 20th, 1991. The CIA classifies the task force report on greater openness to be secret. You just can't make this stuff up. This week in radical history for December 21st, couple items. 1790. Samuel Slater's thread spinning factory goes into production in Rhode Island, the beginning of an industrial revolution in America. The workers at his machines are 4 to 10 year olds. Also on December 21st, 1861, Schooner Porter arrives in Washington, bringing annuity goods for the Meca, hoses, sickles, pitchforks, and Mexican spurs, much to the amusement of the fishing and whaling Miko tribe, who would convert them into fishing hook knives and arrowheads. The ideas of payments of goods from old stockpiles of U.S. goods was a common bait-and-switch tactic by the U.S. government regarding payment issues guaranteed to the tribes. Another example of this was when the government forced horse saddles onto horseless tribe on the shores of Lake Superior. The tribe ended up strapping these saddles onto their canoes. Lastly, on a date in 1907, Chile massacre of workers, women, and children at St. Maria, also known as the Santa Maria School Slaughter, during a strike headed by anarchists. A strike committee was formed by Luis Olea, an important member of the committee, and a bunch of remarkable anarchist militants. The strike headquarters was established in Santa Maria School. Overall, there was 4,500 strikers and supporters in the school and another 1,500 or so camping in tents around the square. The army was called in by the bosses. Martial law was declared. Stores were locked, and on December 21st at 3:45 p.m., the slaughter began. The first to be shot were members of the committee. Chilean, Argentina, Peruvian, Bolivian, and European workers were slain with astonishing ruthlessness, all with their wives and children dead beside them. The number of the victims was reckoned to be of over 3,600.
Never seen anything like it. Tanks, anti-aircraft, infantry. Makes you wish that no one would show up tonight. But if they do, what do you think will happen? Well, it usually happens when people without guns stand up to people with guns.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration came from my comrades who produced the Slingshot Organizer. This year's new organizer is on sale at your local radical establishments. More radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. I leave you now with about 2 more minutes of awesome work done by the new Anarchy Now radio program that does a great job covering the riots in Greece. Both This Week in Radical History and Anarchy Now can be found, as always, at the free download site at radioforall.net. A great resource, and thank you very much, everyone. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever and always yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
The shooting of young Alexis sent a shockwave through the streets of Athens, Greece that day. The next day, following the state's failed reports to cover up the story, claiming that the bullet was a ricochet off of a wall, despite the many eyewitnesses' reports, the people of Athens quickly armed themselves and took to the street in an insurrection. 6 days later, this insurrection has spread throughout Europe, affecting parts of Spain, London, France, Italy, and even going into Turkey, where the prison system and police brutality is far beyond what we understand in the United States of America. But don't take my word for it. Let's go to our voice on the Greek streets to get his eyewitness report.
So, all around Athens and around Greece, there were colorful demonstrations of schoolboys and schoolgirls. Some of them marched to the local police stations and clashed with the police, throwing stones and bottles. And the anger was so really thick. The policemen and police officers had to be locked inside their offices, surrounded by 13 and 14-year-old boys and girls. The picture was so striking that it produced a domino effect. The trade unions of teachers decided an all-out strike for Tuesday. The Union of University Lecturers decided a 3-day strike. And so there was the already arranged general strike you mentioned for Wednesday against the government economic policy, so the process was generalizing, and it still generalizes.
Think of this as a 21st century black plague spreading across the countryside of Europe. How long will this plague take to reach the United States of Moronica? Well, if you're going to ask me why you should riot, maybe you should ask yourself. Well, that's what the people of Europe are doing. The catalyst for the European riots was the police butchering of a 15-year-old boy in the streets of Athens. But the reason for the riots are much more diverse. This is an economic system which, much like ours, disenfranchises a large part of the population while promising wealth to the very few. We don't have time on this program to list the multitude of names of those who have died because of police oppression, but the question I ask is, should I have to? What exactly is our threshold of pain from the state, and when are we willing to fight back? Well, if we can take any cue from our European comrades and compañeros, I guarantee that this system will not stay much longer. But if we continue to buy the rhetoric of hope and change we can believe in, it's guaranteed that this system will never go away. Much of the information for this segment was brought to you by Piracy from Democracy Now! And information given by independent media sources all over the world. Yes, we do have the knowledge, the power, and the text messaging.
That was Anarchy Now! Background music by Silver Mountain Zion.
Sleep now. It'll hurt less in the morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
We begin with news out of Palestine, and of course, it is not good news. We constantly review the news reports out of the West Bank and Gaza, and there is a sickening repetition to it. News of the daily shootings of Palestinians by the Israeli military and Jewish settlers, day in and day out. News of the land confiscation and the discriminatory application of the law. We try not to become numb to this repetition. We dare not become numb. Here are just a few stories from this past week to again jar us into paying attention to the magnitude of the systematic genocide taking place day in and day out, week in and week out, month by month, year by year in the West Bank and Gaza. We begin with a report from Hebron. 13-year-old Mohammed Irsaid thought his older brother had only been shot in the leg when he arrived alone to the hospital and asked for his brother's room number. The police officer at the front desk just looked at me and said, "Your brother isn't in a room. He's a martyr now," Mohammed told Middle East Eye a few hours later in the morning hall where friends and family were gathering to show their respects for the young man. It's the second time in less than 2 months that Mohammed has found himself in the same hall mourning a sibling. Israeli forces shot Uday Irsaid, 24, in the chest and leg during clashes in Hebron City on Friday, killing him just 6.5 weeks after his sister Danya Irsaid, 17, was shot dead at the same city center. Mohammed is now the oldest of his four remaining siblings. He and his brother spent most of their time together. At home, they shared a room, and together they ran the family's small bakery in the center of town. Dania, he said, was the oldest sister and took care of him like a mother. One family, three children killed in a matter of weeks. How would you like to come home to find your house occupied by the military that now lay claim to it? This happens all the time in the West Bank. Here is the latest report. For the last 15 days, a family in Hebron have had no access to the top two floors of their house, which was illegally taken over by the Israeli occupation forces and where they set up a military base. 10 Israeli soldiers suddenly showed up at the house in the neighborhood of Abu Shineh in Hebron. They broke in by smashing a window in the door, took the key, and demanded that the family vacate the third floor. The soldiers did not have any documentation to explain or justify the incursion, nor did they give an explanation to the family why their house was being taken over. Any questions are ignored, and the third floor as well as the rooftop are now off limits to the family. Since the soldiers arrived, they have broken the windows and shot holes in the water tank which supplies clean water to the household. They then took all the blankets on the premises and used them to dry the water leaking from the tanks. The family also reported that once the water supply was fixed, the soldiers contaminated the water and used the apartment and roof as a toilet. The soldiers never leave the apartment empty, but a few times per day there is a shift change. This happens at different times every day, so there is no knowing when, and the soldiers move in and out as they please anyway. This means there can be soldiers moving throughout the building at any time, terrifying the family, especially the young children, who no longer dare to leave the house on their own. The soldiers use the roof as a lookout and also frequently fire weapons such as tear gas from there into the surrounding neighborhood. The three-story family house is home to 13 people, now crowded into two small floors, including a young disabled child. They have no idea how long the soldiers will stay or if the family will ever get their house back at all. And finally, a review of the week from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Last week, 10 Palestinian civilians, including a child, were killed in the West Bank. 70 Palestinian civilians, including 21 children, a female journalist, and a woman, were wounded in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israeli forces put into effect the house demolition policy on grounds of a collective punishment. A house in Nablus was bombed, due to which a mosque and five nearby houses sustained material damage. A number of houses were surveyed, and their occupants were threatened to leave their houses to be demolished. Israeli forces continue to target the border area along the Gaza Strip. Two houses sustained damage because of the Israeli shells. Israeli warplanes raided a training site in the Gaza Strip, but no casualties were reported. Israeli forces conducted 114 incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank just this past week, while 10 Massachusetts senators were visiting Israel on an all-expenses-paid junket sponsored by the Jewish Community Relations Council. You can bet your bottom dollar they did not read about these issues in the Israeli press as they reveled in their public relations tour. Our feature presentation this morning is a conversation between Princeton Professor Emeritus Richard Falk, who also served as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Rights, and Ali Abu Nima, journalist, author, and founder of the Electronic Intifada, that took place in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The conversation followed a lecture delivered by Professor Falk. Their appeal to rationality and diplomacy in the face of failed military approaches to problem-solving in the Middle East is the kind of discussion and approach to conflict resolution that one wishes would take place amongst our so-called diplomats on the international stage. But alas, pure military response continues to dominate as the solution to the Middle East conflict. Here are Richard Falk and Ali Abu Nima from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Well, I'm going to start where you ended. Gave a very compelling argument that there's a pattern in history, especially since World War II, of the underdog who has right on their side winning. Why can't people in power see that?
I think that's a very important issue that I've thought about a lot. And I think the simplistic but still instructive answer is because our bureaucracy and our media have become so militarized over the course of this period since the end of World War II and subsequent decades, that it's both impolitic and unnatural to think outside the military box. And so we keep in reinventing how to win these conflicts that are occurring in the global south. And if you notice the response to Syria and to ISIS or to the Paris attacks, it's always one of let's do more militarily. There's very little freedom of the political imagination to consider non-military ways of resolving conflict. And that's partly because the military budget has remained so high. It's partly because the think tanks in Washington are very capable of sustaining this kind of ideological outlook. I had as a student some years ago, David Petraeus, who made his reputation by reinventing counterinsurgency warfare. That is, trying to say what happened in Vietnam was an anomaly and that we could fix it by treating the civilian population of the target society in a more understanding way and by shifting our tactics using new technologies, drones being the most dramatic example, and finding ways to make the military instruments successful and effective as part of the global domination strategy being pursued by Washington.
Well, today as we speak, the British Parliament voted to send the UK's 203 remaining warplanes into Syria. There was a big debate about that. Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader, who is a long-time anti-war activist and supporter of Palestinian rights, spoke eloquently and I think sensibly about the long history of not just the failure of war, but its tendency to produce more violence. And yet, a majority voted yet again for more bombing. Are there alternatives to bombing?
Yes, of course. Again, I should have said in my earlier answer that it's not just the political establishment that has learned to think within this military box. It's also the political consciousness that has governed Western understandings of security. And it is deeply embedded in our own society, and one dimension of it is the gun culture. We think, we identify in a very dysfunctional way the power to destroy with the ability to be secure. And that's a very false identification. Now, we are capable of doing something other than this if it's not seen as an immediate threat. For instance, we have been talking privately to the Taliban in Afghanistan with the idea of trying to find a political formula that is an alternative to what would otherwise seem to be permanent warfare in the country. So one can ask, why can we talk to the enemy in Afghanistan, but not in these other settings? Why do we treat Hamas differently than the Taliban? Or why do we not even consider that there may be grievances that these groups have? I have mentioned sometimes a presentation that John Major made about his diplomacy in Northern Ireland, where he said that he only made progress in reaching some kind of ceasefire and accommodation in Northern Ireland when he stopped thinking of the IRA as a terrorist organization and began realizing that they were a political actor that had grievances, and if those grievances were addressed, diplomacy was possible.
To come back to come back to the question of international law. You gave in your remarks a very comprehensive indictment of the failure of the United Nations on the question of Palestine. And I know that I, like many others, will continue to cite this UN resolution or that UN resolution, or point out how many resolutions are being breached by Israeli settlements or the siege of Gaza or any number of other practices. In your role as UN Special Rapporteur, your role was to investigate, to present the results objectively of what you found, and to recommend action. It must have been very frustrating for you to see those recommendations so consistently ignored or set aside. So I have two questions. Can you recall, tell us some of the inner workings of how the pressure, pressure within the UN works? And secondly, how do you retain, or do you retain any faith in the possibility of international law after being UN Special Rapporteur and dealing with Israel?
No, those are important, quite searching questions. Let me say two things at first. The UN is no better or worse than the behavior of its most important members. That's a people forget that.
And that's Micronesia and the Marshall Islands.
But it's also Libya. See, when geopolitical forces want the UN to be effective, it can be very effective, maybe too effective. But when the geopolitical forces, as has been the case over the years with Palestine, are trying to resist UN authority, then UN authority cannot be implemented behaviorally. But it's very important, my second point is, it's very important to recognize that the UN, despite its limitations in implementing in a behaviorally relevant way these resolutions that you refer to, it has a great deal of symbolic leverage. It is the most important venue for resolving claims about what is just in the world. And the whole buildup of the global solidarity movement has rested in large part, or I'd say in significant part, on the fact that it is reinforced by international law and by UN authority. The UN is a failure for Palestine behaviorally, but it's a success and important asset for the Palestinian struggle symbolically. And that's why Israel and indirectly the U.S. get so furious with the UN. If it mattered not at all, it would be ignored. The Israelis are not stupid. They understand, and they've made a great emphasis in recent years on what they call the delegitimation project as threatening to their future security. And the delegitimation project is essentially saying we're losing the struggle to control the moral and legal heights, and that has political implications. What those implications are remains to be seen. It doesn't always come out the way one would like it to come out. And I sometimes refer to Tibet as a leading example where the Dalai Lama has led a successful legitimacy war on behalf of the Tibetan people, but the geopolitical forces are too strong to overcome. And so China has successfully maintained its position of dominance and control. So I think what it's important to understand, both for the UN and international law, is its limitations, but also its usefulness. And one has to think in very concrete and sometimes in institutional terms about where it can be useful. Also, what is the role of civil society? Civil society activism on the Palestinian issue, I think, relies very much on the congruence between its objectives and the sense of what is morally and legally right.
You've talked about that struggle, you write about it, that what you call the legitimacy war or legitimacy struggle. You've spoken and written about that, and the role of civil society activism, particularly boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is a Palestinian-led movement that began a decade ago and is, to a large extent, modeled on the kind of sanctions and boycott and pressure that was put on apartheid South Africa. There's been a counter attack, let's say, by Israel, not surprisingly, and by Israel lobby groups. But it's included in recent, in the past year or two, legislative efforts in various state legislatures and in the U.S. Congress to limit this movement. Is boycott, divestment, and sanctions a legitimate set of tactics? Is it free speech? And what legitimacy do these legislative and other efforts have to suppress it?
Well, I think there's no doubt in my mind that until the relevance of what I was calling the special relationship entered the process, no one questioned the legality and legitimacy of boycott and divestment, nonviolent tactics designed to express a political and moral point of view. There was much opposition to the use of these tactics in the South African context, including at my university at Princeton. The Board of Trustees and the President were very much opposed to it, but no one even thought to question its legality as a tactic. It was a political issue. Was it more important to keep the investments of the university free from moral and political concerns, or was it more important to show solidarity with the struggle against apartheid? It was seen in those terms. And if, in a way, it's an extension, your question is an extension of my main presentation. This is the domestic, deforming repercussions of the special relationship. We wouldn't do this with any other country, probably not even with Saudi Arabia. It is only because of this status that Israel has achieved that we're willing to undercut our own traditions of civil liberties and human rights in order to insulate this special relationship from the kind of pressures that are being mounted.
I don't know if it's a challenge, but throw something else in on this question of the special relationship. There's no doubt that there is a special relationship. There's no doubt that the Israel lobby exercises tremendous power and influence in this country, particularly on political elites. We see that in the crushingly lopsided votes taken in Congress in, any time during the war on Gaza, for example, when Israel was killing 11 children a day in Gaza in the summer of 2014. But at the same time, there are signs of fractures, and I want to give you a couple and see what you make of them. There were a number of polls during Israel's attack on Gaza in the summer of 2014 that showed that major subgroups of the U.S. population opposed what Israel was doing. That included the Democratic Party base. It included young people, and it included people of color. And one of the stark examples of that was a Gallup poll that showed that people over 30 supported Israel's attack on Gaza by, I think, 51% to 25. But for under 30s, it was the reverse, the complete reverse. So that's one indicator. Again, there's a trend in the polling that we see. Another is that when Benjamin Netanyahu came to the United States, I think in March, to give his speech to Congress, 60 members of Congress boycotted it, which is unprecedented. And then in the battle waged over the deal with Iran, the Israel lobby is seen as having completely lost that battle. Is that just a limited difference between Israel and the United States, or does it portend some kind of bigger shift?
Well, I think it's a mixture of the two. I think there is a shift in the political consciousness of the people living in this country, particularly the young, as that poll indicates. And I've noticed in my own experience that those that support Israel are much less inclined than they were a few years ago to engage on the substance of issues that are raised, like the argument over the invasion of the attack on Gaza in 2014. And in a way, that gap between the shifting public opinion and the failure to make any commensurate adjustment in Washington illustrates part of the problem to me. It's very hard to translate changing. I think the American public would accept a normal relationship with Israel at this time, but the Beltway wouldn't. And it's finding a way to create a new situation where Washington gets the message. And it's a message in the interest of even the American strategic objectives in the world. It's not a radical message, actually. It would serve the cause of the Kissingers of this world to deal with Israel as a normal country and to seek a genuine political accommodation. Your other two examples, the Netanyahu, the walkout of the 60 senators, you have to put that in the context that this was an outrageous intrusion on American political normalcy. To have a foreign leader come to a joint session of Congress and attack a principal foreign policy objective of the elected president just before his own election. The fact that the rest of the Congress stayed there and applauded is what seems to me to be the most salient feature of that event. The outrage of allowing this kind of presentation, of sabotaging a very important foreign policy initiative that was not only an American initiative. All five of the permanent members of the Security Council were supportive of the move to resolve the Iranian nuclear issue in this way, plus Germany. And again, the agreement itself was so strongly supported by the Western alliance and by the major powers in the world that that even the special relationship couldn't stand up successfully in opposition to it. But again, I think it's a not a it's a moment in that special relationship that's like an unexpected change in the direction of the current. Since the agreement, the U.S. has gone out of its way to reassure Israel that nothing has changed. It sent a high official, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, to make as nice as possible with Netanyahu in Tel Aviv. It has offered Israel even more military assistance than the $3 billion that we already
give. They're talking, I think, about renewing. I think they do the U.S. military aid deal on a 10-year
yes.
term. So what's being published is that they're talking about renewing it from 2017 for $5 billion a year.
Yeah, right. See, that's all so-called compensation for the fact that we didn't do what Israel wanted us to do, which would have been horribly destructive. Of stability, well, I shouldn't say stability, but it would have contributed to intensification of the turbulence and the danger of real spreading regional war in the Middle East. And it would have been a great blow to American leadership of the Western alliance, because the European countries very much wanted this agreement. So my sense is that the special relationship is alive and well, and that nothing fundamental has changed.
I want to, in your opening remarks, you said something that appears, I think, does make a lot of sense, that with all the regional turmoil and the calamities that are going on for so many people in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, and other in Yemen, that in a sense the focus has moved away from Palestine. You also pointed out that the longevity of what Palestinians have been enduring for decade upon decade. I want to put something different to you, that Israel is, in a sense, central to so much of what is happening, and I mean it in a specific sense. Israel has been offering a very specific narrative, the one that you offer in terms of your analysis based on international law, looking at Palestinian rights, making comparisons with Northern Ireland or South Africa, which says in a very simplified way, there is an injustice, there are grievances. If you resolve them politically and give people their due, then conflict goes away. It can diminish and eventually you can have peace. The narrative that Israel and many of its supporters in the United States are offering, and you saw this after the Paris attacks recently and after so many incidences, no, this isn't about Palestinian rights. This is a civilizational war between the democratic, rational, liberal West of which Israel is the vanguard, and the savage, barbaric, extremist, irrational East. And that narrative has been around for a long time, but it seems to be taking root more and more broadly. How do we, first of all, do you see that, and what can we do to resist it and to defeat this notion that we are destined to permanent civilizational and religious war?
No, you formulate that issue, which is, I think, a very central issue in a very clear and useful way. I think every time a spectacular terrorist incident occurs of the sort that occurred in Paris, the Israeli leadership tries to say, that's what we're up against. You know, it tries to associate ISIS phenomenon with the Palestinian struggle. And Netanyahu was explicit in saying that. Sharon, after the 9/11 attack, said, Yasser Arafat is our Osama bin Laden. You know, with creating that kind of equation. And it really builds on the Samuel Huntington Clash of Civilizations hypothesis that was set forth in the early 1990s. And I think the only way of getting beyond that is by exposing its essentially polemical character, that if you look closely at the Palestinian struggle, you'll see that it has pursued reasonable goals in a way that is proportional to what justice and law would prescribe. And it has very little to do with political extremism. Even Hamas, when it entered the political process in 2006, at the urging, interestingly, of Washington, I think made a fundamental decision that they would pursue their goals by political means. And they basically abandoned an armed struggle scenario. That didn't mean they abandoned the option of responding to violence with whatever means they possessed. But it does mean that they didn't look to liberation or Palestinian emancipation through some kind of liberation. And they've indicated that they would settle for a 50-year coexistence arrangement provided Israel withdrew to 1967 borders. So it seems to me that that effort to portray the Palestinian struggle as an example of the problem of containing political extremism is just a way of manipulating ideologically the real situation. You say, what can we be done about it? I think it was somebody on the Supreme Court that said long ago, truth is the best disinfectant. And I think that's what meetings like this seek to do, is to get beyond the polemical and propagandistic ways of understanding violence and conflict in the world, and examine where are the constructive opportunities that will lead us in the direction of sustainable peace.
Thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you for the question.
That was Richard Folk and Ali Abu Nima in conversation from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And finally, we will close with a Palestinian voice, that of Ayman Odeh. Ayman Odeh is an Arab-Israeli lawyer and politician. He's a member of the Knesset and currently serves as leader of Hadash and head of the Joint List, a political alliance of four Arab-dominated parties. Here is an excerpt from a speech he gave at a conference sponsored by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in New York City.
Arab citizens comprise one-fifth of Israel's population. We cannot bring peace, democracy, and equality on our own, but neither can Israel reach peace, democracy, and equality without us. What does it mean to be unwanted? It is piercing stares when your fellow passengers on the bus hear you answer your phone in Arabic. It is sending out your CV to find a job, knowing that your Arab name will outweigh your academic achievements. It is when you are finally able to buy your first family home and your would-be neighbors take to the streets to protest you and 42 other families moving to the neighborhood. It is Prime Minister Netanyahu warning his supporters on election day that the Arabs are turning out in droves to the polling places, as if even your right to vote is a threat. It is when 100,000 citizens live with no water, no electricity, no government-supported schools, no national health care services, not even a paved road. In the Negev, Arab communities have lived since before the founding of the state, but the Israeli government refuses to recognize their villages. Tens of thousands of Israeli citizens in the Negev live under constant threat of expulsion from their lands. A demolition order is hanging over the heads of the people of Umm al-Hiran. The government plans to strip Umm al-Hiran of its Arab name and its Arab population and build a new Jewish community called Hiran in its place. This shows an ugly reality and a very hard truth. The village is not being destroyed because of its geography or planning issues. It is being destroyed because it is Arab residents are unwanted. How can it be that I still have hope? This week, I met with African-American leaders in Atlanta, Georgia, the capital of America's Black Civil Rights Movement. I had the great privilege to visit the Ebenezer Baptist Church where the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. preached. The Civil Rights Movement believed that black people and white people had to join together and struggle together to reach freedom and justice. I have hope because when the government tried to throw us out of the political process and deprive us of our rights, we chose to join together and struggle together. We established a joint list, Arab and Jewish. Instead of surrendering to segregation, we chose to lead the way to openness and inclusion. We at the Joint List are living proof that Arabs and Jews can refuse to be enemies. We at the Joint List are living proof that Arabs and Jews can refuse to be enemies and that we can share our society as equals. The Netanyahu government is chipping away at what is left of Israel's democratic sphere, repressing freedom of speech and silencing dissent. In the last year, the government has threatened the independence of the Supreme Court and introduced laws to delegitimize human rights organizations. I don't accept the cynical arithmetic that says that all Jews must be against all Arabs and all Arabs against all Jews. I believe in the power of Arabs and Jews struggling together against racism and for democracy.
That was Arab-Israeli Knesset member Ayman Odeh speaking at a conference sponsored by the newspaper Haaretz in New York City. And that concludes our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Thank you.
atheists in the strictest sense of the word. They are humanists. That's their religion. At the highest level, their goal is to create a world in which the adepts, the thousand points of light, working behind the veil to create the culmination of the great plan, can realize the ultimate happiness for mankind. That's why they say you should not be put in jail for the rest of your life for murder or anything else. There should be no death penalty. Because it was a learning experience. And having gone through that learning experience, you're a better person now. This is what they teach.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Britain's part of the US coalition bombing Syria now, but is our real target ISIS, Assad, or Putin? We collect together some experts on the region this evening to untangle the web of this bombing campaign without clear priorities or long-term military plan, which Britain's alliance with so-called moderate jihadis threatens to turn Syria into another Libya or Iraq. And as we go into the festive season with the bloody Paris attacks fresh in our memory, but only the police and press's word for who really carried them out, we ask, are we entering a new era where terror attacks like 9/11, 7/7 and Paris begin to happen so fast and furious that everyone's dead and there are no proper trials and nobody has time to question police and TV reports before it's time for the next one? Sounds a bit like Iraq right now, doesn't it? And where our ignoring international law just creates more recruits to the extremist cause. And have the jihadis got a point? Are our own corporations, banks and governments becoming so despotic they pose a danger to humanity? Plus Martin Summers' weekly chance if he wishes to take us on a tour of other hotspots, but we're certainly sticking mainly with Syria in the second hour of this programme. I'm pleased to introduce anti-war campaigner Mehrnaz Shahabi. Hi, Mehrnaz. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thank you.
Now, I know you were born in Iran. How do you think you view what's going on in Syria now being in the UK, but being born in Iran?
Well, what is happening in Syria is really tragic. After what we experienced in Iraq and in Libya recently, in 2011. Seeing the replay of that in Syria is really is tragic for the loss of word. And also I think whatever is happening to Syria is really a prelude for a similar scenario being played out in Iran.
I wonder what you make of the comment I made at the top of the hour, which is, who are we really after? Is it ISIS? Is it Assad? Or is it Putin? I mean, you're mentioning also the country you were born in, Iran, too.
Who Britain is targeting? Well, I think that Britain is really has been instigating the whole scenario in Syria. It has been collaborating with the jihadists. And, for example, we know of the former French foreign minister, Roland Dumas, who said that in 2013, on a trip to Britain, the British offered him collaboration in regime change in Syria.
Well, just to make that absolutely clear, he said it on television in 2013. But he was talking way back to 2009.
That's right, absolutely. That is before the problems started in Syria and actually also also from WikiLeaks documents, we know that the regime change agenda in Syria goes at least as early as 2005. And by financing the NGOs, preparing them for regime change, and also arming the Sunni opposition, trying to create conflicts between different ethnic and religious groups in Syria.
Well, some would argue, Menas, that those conflicts were there already, and it's the fact that the government of Saddam Hussein was overthrown, and also, of course, that there's been pushing of the Syrian government back to Damascus, away from large areas of Syria, that actually those that, because there is no effective government in those areas, that those conflicts were there anyway.
The conflicts in Syria. The conflicts in Syria did not. Bashar Assad was a very popular government. Of course, we can't say that it was. What government is absolutely popular with everyone or hasn't got any problems? But we didn't have bombings and ethnic strife. There wasn't a civil war situation in Syria. There were legitimate grievances and there were protests, but jihadists and armed opposition groups were inserted into the protests right from the start, and they militarized the situation. In fact, a lot of people refer to the situation in Daraa, that they say that the Syrian government shot at the demonstrators. But in fact, there are witnesses, including an Italian priest who had been living in Syria for 50 years. And he says that it was actually the jihadists that they were in the crowd shooting at the demonstrators and the police. So there is a lot of evidence about these people having been inserted into the crowd, and we hardly hear anything about the killing of Syrian police, the army, and the citizens.
Well, it sounds to me as if a lot of the judicial process in all of this is just simply not happening, whether it's on a local or an international level, and it's just being left up to the international press, a lot of it the London-based, New York based press to decide what's really happened. And I'm joined on the line also by Dan Glazebrook, who's author of Divide and Ruin and a journalist himself. Hi Dan, welcome to the Politics
Hi.
Show.
Can you
give us your take on what the real objectives are in Syria? We've got several on the plate at the moment, on the table, should I say. We've got possibly ISIS, possibly Assad, and possibly a longer game with Putin.
Well, the target of the regime change in Syria is still Assad, is still the regime, is still the government. It's the Syrian state is the target and has been since, as Maynard said, 4 years ago, the West and its allies in the region began inserting armed fighters and flooding weapons into the hands of the most sectarian militias in the region and funneling them into Syria. To destabilize and bring down the Syrian state. That's been the agenda for the last 4 years. It was done under the cover, initially, of peaceful protests, some were peaceful, some were not. But from the start, that's what it's been. It's been an insertion of sectarian militias armed and funded and trained by the West and its regional allies. And that's still exactly what's going on today. If you look at Cameron, what he said in the House of Commons last Wednesday, he was very explicit. Right from the first few minutes, he admitted the ultimate goal is still, in his euphemism, you know, the euphemisms they always talk in, his goal is Assad. They'd like to personalize it. What he means by that is the ultimate goal is still to destroy the Syrian state, just as the goal in Iraq was not Saddam, was not the target. The target was the destruction of the Iraqi state, which was achieved. And the goal in 2011... the target was not Gaddafi as such, although it was important that both of those figures were killed. And I don't think they'll leave Syria until Assad himself is personally killed. But they're not the be-all and end-all of the target. The target of the West is the Syrian state itself. And they won't leave either until they feel that Syria has been crippled and prevented from any time in the future being a genuine regional power that can represent its people, that can forge its own independent foreign policy, support the Palestinians, make alliances with the Global South, which is what Syria has been punished for. So that was the agenda in 2011, going back to 2009, according to Ronald Dumas, as you say, is the agenda today. And ISIS is just a cover. It's a ruse. speaker after speaker in the House of Commons pointed out ISIS are nowhere near, sorry, that the 70,000 so-called moderate troops that Cameron talks about are nowhere near ISIS. He says they're going to be leading the fight against ISIS, but these are people whose only, all we know about them, is that they're committed to killing Syrian soldiers and police, and often members of rival religious faiths as well. That's all we know about them. Their relations are a bit hot-cold with ISIS, because ISIS is not their target any more than ISIS is the West's target. Their target and the Western government's target is still the Syrian state. So, yeah, there's absolutely no doubt. Cameron made it very clear. Just want to finish, if I may, on this point that Frank Field raised in Parliament, Labour MP. Very interesting. He said, look, the strategy of the US over the past year when they've been bombing ISIS is to, whenever they see that ISIS are massacring Syrian soldiers, to leave them to it, give them a free hand, not bomb them when they're doing that. Right? So, and he was, Frank Field asked, will this be the British strategy? And Cameron's weasel-worded answer basically implied, yes, people I'd encourage your listeners to read it on Hansard for themselves. He basically didn't say no, right? He didn't deny that that would be their strategy, to give ISIS a free hand so long as it's slaughtering Syrian and police. And at the same time, he explicitly said these 70,000 fighters who are anti-Assad fighters, they're not anti-ISIS fighters, the RAF will be their air force. We were going to give air cover to them. So the way I see it, you see the Syrian opposition groups, the rebel groups, the militias in Syria, anti-government militias, divided into three. And the British government strategy towards how it uses each of those in this big grand play of regime change is slightly different in each case. So you've got these 70,000 that Cameron said, yep, we will, you know, continue to pour weapons into their hand, train them. William Hague talked about the possibility of special forces inserted on the ground, which I'm sure there are already, but openly doing that to a much larger extent to help organize them more effectively, and the RAF will give them air cover. That's open and explicit. Those are the people we're going to directly support. Now, the wording of the motion said ISIS will be the exclusive target of airstrikes, meaning Al-Qaeda, which has actually led the main territorial gains that have taken place in Syria this year against the government, has been a new Al-Qaeda-forged alliance called the Army of Conquest, with help from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, in which many of the groups that Cameron openly supports are part of that Al-Qaeda-led alliance. And Al-Qaeda will not be targeted by airstrikes, so they'll be given an open and free hand. And at the same time, ISIS will be bombed only in as much as they cause disunity in the ranks of the death squads, only in as much as they fight against these other hand-picked militias of Cameron's. As long as they're focused on fighting and killing Syrian soldiers, they'll be given a free hand. So this is the kind of grand strategy by which Britain and the US and its regional partners hope to unify all of these opposition groups, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and push them towards smashing the Syrian state even more effectively. And the airstrikes are part of that grand strategy, part and parcel of it, a carrot and stick approach to ISIS. Please go ahead and massacre Syrian soldiers. We'll leave you alone. But don't attack the other anti-government fighters who we're going to help in a big push on Assad as well, directly.
But you see, since the Russians are backing Assad up, effectively, you know, an enormous superpower, nuclear power, backing Assad up, isn't this inevitably, ultimately, going to lead to the Western powers, the NATO powers, coming into conflict with the Russians, because the Russians are not going to allow Assad now to be overthrown, particularly because of their, I think it's Tarsus, their base, which really gives the Russians access to the Eastern Mediterranean.
Yeah.
I mean, even Napoleon was trying to push out, hundreds of years ago, push the Russians out from having influence in that region, and Turkey and Eastern Europe. And the Russians are definitely not going to allow their influence in the Middle East to go, Dan. I wonder what you make of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why it's, you know, it's building up to a very, very tense affair over the past, how far back do you want to go since at least 1917, Russia has been a target of Western containment, contain its power, you know, strip it of its influence and try and weaken it and destroy it, really. That hasn't particularly changed since the end of the Cold War, and especially it's got worse under Putin, not because of anything Putin's done, but except for the fact that he's shown that he's not going to be pushed around and he wants to have independent foreign policy. So things are hotting up, and there is a potential for a clash. You're absolutely right. But Syria is really the an Assyrian who actually moved to the UK and said something that really made sense to me. She said Syria's become the Stalingrad, really, of the modern era, the era of imperialist war. You know, Syria may well be become the Stalingrad of the regime changes. You know, the regime change that actually doesn't take place because of, yes, Russian support, yes, Iranian and Hezbollah support, but also the steadfastness of the Russian people themselves. And in that regard, it's worth noting that the so-called... Now, one of the things in the House of Commons debate that was totally torn to shreds was Cameron's assertion that there were 70,000 moderate fighters. The military chiefs who gave him that figure didn't even claim that when they were questioned by some of the committees. They admitted that over half of them could in no way be termed moderates, basically. And I would argue that de facto none of them can be called moderates because there's nothing moderate about going and killing soldiers and police. Especially
They're even called the opposition, aren't they? The Syrian opposition.
Yeah, exactly. Not opposition to ISIS.
I don't think they're
opposition
quite
to
like
the government.
The Labour Party. I can't imagine them sitting in the Houses of Parliament all with automatic rifles. I mean, it's not quite...
Well, this is the thing, is that people say, oh, there's very few moderates left in Syria now after 4 years of civil war, and that's true, but that's not only true because they've been killed or radicalised. That's true because in 2012, Assad launched a serious programme of reforms that pretty much met all of the demands of the original peaceful protests, which allowed multi-party elections, ended the one-party state, you know, brought other parties into parliament and coalition government. You've got the Communist Party now is involved, other parties, the national coordinating committees who set up some of those initial peaceful protests were brought on board into a peaceful process of negotiating, and actually out of those negotiations came a serious package of reforms. And that's where the moderates have gone. They haven't just been wiped out or become radicalized. They've actually realized what's going on, and they've become critical supporters of the government side in the civil war because they see it's designed to undermine the whole fabric of their society.
But Dan, what about...
So the moderates are there, but they're working with the government.
What about this claim many people made? Actually, quite a lot of the students and pupils, school pupils that had turned out in a protest, 500 of them on College Green here in Bristol on Wednesday evening, saying, well, actually, this is going to help as a recruitment tool for ISIS. They're bombing innocent civilians. That's effectively what happens, is that people start actually saying, well, they start queuing up at the door of ISIS saying, we want to join.
Well, absolutely. And this has been the genius, the evil genius, really, of the Western states and how they've manipulated forces of radicalized political Islam that have, you know, for very good reasons, come to understand that the you know, the Western states are the enemies of their countries, which happen to be Muslim countries. So that's not only a narrative, it happens also to be a fact, right? The West has been undermining those Muslim societies, has been destroying them. And the really sad thing about groups like ISIS, they've allowed themselves to be manipulated in a place that they're acting as tools of the very Western regime change policy that are destroying their countries. But you're right. But you know, this is where they get part of their appeal, is precisely by the media presenting them as these bad boys who are against the West and so on. They're not. They're fulfilling Western policy, but it absolutely is crucial to their recruitment to be able to pose as the new anti-Western bad boys on the block, because there is anger at the West. And you're right. The airstrikes, of course, feed into this narrative that the West sees ISIS as a deadly enemy, which it still doesn't. It still sees it as a very useful tool to achieve its goals, which haven't changed. So, absolutely, bombing is not effective in terms of reducing ISIS's power, but is effective at acting as a recruiting sergeant. I'd agree with that.
Martin was talking before the news about the Paris attacks, Dan, saying, well, actually, it's a lot of questions still about whether there was actually any real Syria refugee stroke migrant involvement in those attacks at all, since everybody's been killed, apart from one person apparently who's been on the run. I just wonder what you think about the causes which were being given as to why, I mean, actually, under international law, David Cameron is claiming that Britain is under attack after the Paris attacks, and therefore that bombing Syria is something that Britain can do under international law, under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, in self-defence.
Well, look, here's the great irony again, is that, yes, if you do destroy societies, then you make people hate you, and if you destroy states, then you turn them into, training, basically giant training camps. If you turn over the armories of states and create failed states in which militias can go and raid the armories and from throughout the region go and arm themselves, as has happened with Libya. Libya was basically, the 2011 bombing campaign had the effect of turning over the entire armory of a modern industrialized state to the region's most sectarian violent death squads and militias like Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and so on. So, yeah, if you create that misery, and then you create the conditions in which sectarian groups can thrive, and, of course, can fund themselves, because failed states are also the passage for the drugs that come up over the sea of the Atlantic and then up through North Africa, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and so on, fund themselves through that trade and various other trades, the oil trade. So you create failed states, you can create the three conditions necessary for those kind of groups to begin to operate as global players. You create the misery for recruitment, you create this means of financing themselves, and you give them the weapons and destroy the state power. So absolutely, that is creating a danger then for the entire world. So in that sense, you know, it's true to say, you know, these kind of groups are threat to the globe and so on. But what's missing there is any understanding, and this is throughout the House of Commons debate, this total denial of, well, hasn't the West been the main force that's been creating the conditions for these groups to flourish? And isn't this very strategy of airstrikes actually feeding into doing more of the same? So, it is dangerous to have turnover states and their armories to these groups.
I totally agree with Dan.
That's a reason not to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dan, but I also think that apart from the false flag operations that Martin referred to, the idea that Cameron says that it is our right to go there and we'll be defending ourselves and the security of Britain is totally absurd. The jihadists that have been actually manufactured, created, they are all over the world. There are 80 countries are going there. I mean, these threats can happen anywhere. Whether false flag operations or actual jihadist threat, they could be anywhere. And in fact, these threats actually multiplies this threat to the British citizens. Yeah. But I really genuinely believe that this is not the concern of David Cameron and his cohort, because they're actually feeding on this.
Yeah. I mean, it fits into their domestic plans to create a police state with full police and security, full security state. Spying powers and full police powers of repression to get all the legal tools in place before the next economic crash. So that when there are, you know, when the cash machines dry up and, you know, there are millions of people with no prospect of job and no benefits, when these conditions emerge, they've got the full legal apparatus of repression ready in place. And ISIS and the so-called threat of terror attack absolutely justifies all of that and effectively emotionally sort of marches the House of Commons into voting for all of that stuff. So so absolutely, it works for him on every level, really.
If I just add to that, but the legality of this is completely to be questioned. I mean, I've been reading legal opinions by people who know about international law, which say that there is no legal basis for you to bomb inside Syria. And Assad's pointed this out. The Russians have taken the line, well, we don't think there's any legal basis for you to be here, but we are prepared on a pragmatic basis to cooperate with you. But I'd just like to hear the comments from both of the other contributors. It's come out in the last 48 hours that coalition forces, they didn't specify the Americans, killed three Syrian soldiers in an airstrike in Syria, which was then followed by an ISIS attack upon their position. And, of course, if we're going to get into a situation where the coalition, including the RAF, are acting as the Air Force, either for the moderate rebels or for ISIS, then we're on a collision course with the Syrian Arab Army, which has taken over 60,000 casualties fighting these people, and the Russian Air Force. And it puts the Russians and the Syrians in a very difficult position, because although they've made it clear that they're not very happy about having this intervention by powers which have not actually got a legal basis to be there, on a pragmatic basis, they've tended. I mean, for Hollande, Putin was saying to Hollande, okay, we will, you know, as long as you tell us what your planes are doing, we'll tell you what our planes are doing. And of course, the Russians believe that the shooting down of their plane was because they were giving information to NATO about where their planes were, which was why the Turks were able to shoot them down as easily as they were. And the other thing that's happening, which needs to be recognised, is that the Turks have sent a military force into Iraq near Mosul. The suggestion I've read is that they are trying to protect ISIS's supply lines. But the Iraqi government has said, you've got to get out of there because we don't want you in there. And that there's also suggestions in the Iraqi parliament that they want to break the link with Britain and America, kick them out, and bring the Russians in to take on ISIS properly. So we're reaching a kind of point where all of these things are coming to a head.
Exactly.
Well, in relation to the illegality of it, yes, it's absolutely illegal. And in fact, it's a war crime. Britain didn't have any legality, either the United Nations Charter or a Chapter 7, to go to Syria. Now, in relation to Turks going into Iraq, the Americans, 200 special forces are going to be sent to Iraq, and al-Abadi has actually objected to that. They have
said
on
this business of legality, surely we're way beyond that. I mean, we started with an illegal war in Iraq. I mean, the attack on Libya was really sticking two fingers up at the Russians and the Chinese over the UN Security Council. And so we've moved beyond that, haven't we, Dan?
Once you see that that this is a war against, as you say, against Syria and Russia, and not a war against ISIS. In fact, a war that aims to utilize ISIS in that war against Russia and Syria. Once you see that, everything falls into place. They've been shooting down Russian planes, as you say. There's troops being sent illegally to Iraq. Because remember, there's been this 4+1 coalition that's built up in opposition to the Western-sponsored death squads in Syria, which has been Russia, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Hezbollah. And, you know, especially the Russian intervention, direct intervention in Syria, began 2 months ago, that we really must be very naive to think, will the West just let their, you know, they've for 4 years been saying Assad must go. You know, we're going to destroy the Syrian state. We've staked our credibility on it. You know, we've put it on the line. That's what's going to happen. And do you think they're going to let the Russians defeat that project without throwing everything they've got into the fire? They are at war with Russia and Syria now. That's absolutely correct. And Iraq as well, because Iraq actually does want to fight ISIS. And as you say, it wants the help of the people who actually also want to fight these groups, which is Russia. So they're not going to let Iraq. They didn't spend $3 trillion on a war in Iraq in order to see it stabilize itself in alliance with Russia. Certainly not. So they're going to throw everything they've got into this fight. It's very, very dangerous.
I think it's just time, because I interviewed for our dialect programme earlier this week, which you can see used to be on BCFM here, but it's not anymore. You can only get it as a podcast, I'm afraid. That's on www.dialectradio.co.uk. I interviewed from the US website 21st Century Wire a chap called Patrick Henningsen earlier this week, and I hope you can manage to stay with us. Totally totally understand if you can't, Dan, but I just thought I'd be interesting to get his take on where he thought this was all heading, and really from a almost sort of stick Patrick Henningsen on a satellite orbiting the Earth, or maybe even on the moon, looking down from a completely his own perspective, in order to try and cut through some of what the mainstream media and many of our MPs have been telling us about this conflict.
Mm.
It's no secret to anyone that NATO intelligence is active and egging on instability in the Ukraine and now in the Crimea. And there's also reports of Chechenian Islamist fighters, many of whom have done the rotation in Syria, are now fighting in the Crimea. They've had attacks on Crimean infrastructure, specifically the electrical grid, in the last couple of weeks. Plus, you have the neo-Nazi factions, that right sector factions NATO's been working with. This is a really, really ugly a multi-front war that's being fought against Russia, essentially. That's my opinion of it. If you look at the Ukraine, Crimea, and Syria, NATO got away with murder in Libya by cheating a UN resolution, but at the same time, they hamstrung potential future operations. So basically, that was the final sort of card, if you will. They laid their whole hand on the table in Libya. And to me, that's the that was the death knell of NATO as we once knew it, and it must be replaced by an EU army. And we've had calls from various leaders. Tony Blair mentioned it in his speech at the Henry Kissinger lecture series just a few days ago. David Cameron and Angela Merkel are doing some horse trading with regards to the EU, and the quid pro quo is Britain's going to be more considerate towards this idea of an EU army. But basically, Tony, I think it's a done deal. But it's just finding the political structures in public to make it seem like it's a good thing to have a federal army in Europe.
That's Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire there. Dan, if you're still with us, I wonder if you'd just like to round up by saying where you think, I mean, just give us a crystal ball. Where's this all heading?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to say. But one of the main reasons it's difficult to say is because it's so horrifying to actually articulate where it looks like it's going. And where it looks like it's going, as you say, is a World War III scenario. They're increasingly openly at war with Russia now. It's been an economic war for a couple of years. It's been a war of containment for much longer than that. The war, all of these wars are against multiple enemies. And the war against Libya and the war against Iraq, of course they're wars against Libya and Iraq, but they're also... And the war against Syria is most definitely a war against Iran as well as against Syria, Syria being Iran's only Arab ally, and its link, crucially, to Hezbollah, which is the only thing that stops Iran getting blitzed by the Israelis, or one of the main effective deterrents they have, at least, against an Israeli attack on Iran. So the war in Libya, you know, Libya, basically they'll take out powers that they feel potentially are powers that are... could contribute serious resources or muscle of some sort to Iran and China. They're trying to isolate Iran and China by picking out their regional allies and wiping them out. And now we've got to a stage where we've had economic war that's developed into all our economic war for the last year and a half, and now it increasingly is a shooting war under the guise of, oops, sorry, that was a mistake, or, oh, that was just a little one-off response to a little incursion. But, you know, it's only going to escalate. I can't see it not escalating. And that's the unfortunate reality that we seem to be sleepwalking into. People are talking about comparisons of 1914. And whilst, of course, there are many differences, there are many similarities. And just to finish, I think one thing that struck me again in the debate in the House of Commons was how we really need to stop just fantasizing history and actually really do learn the lessons. Because there's a lot of Hillary Benn's argument for supporting airstrikes and ISIS was basically boils down to, well, imagine ISIS were the Nazis and imagine it's the 1930s. That was basically his argument. And there were many, many parallels about fascism. They always wheel out this issue of, oh, well, you know, we've tried appeasement. Hitler doesn't work. These kind of people, you can't appease them. You have to fight them. The real lesson, the real truth about the 1930s and the rise of Hitler, where the comparison of fascism and ISIS is really worth paying attention to, is that Hitler was brought to power and supported and bankrolled by the West, by the Western banking institutions. He couldn't have armed himself without them. And he was pushed into war with Russia. He was, you know, given Czechoslovakia on a plate. He was practically ordered to send his armies east. You know, he was basically, you know, given the absolute green light to march his armies into Russia. He was bankrolled and equipped to do so. And, you know, the Western banking institution built him up for that reason. Now, there's the real parallel with ISIS, is once again, we have the West building up these groups to throw them into war against Russia. And so that's the situation we kind of sleepwalking into. So there is a real comparison with both the 30s and the 1910s here, and that's very worrying indeed.
Yeah, okay. Dan, can you just remind us whereabouts we can find you online or even meet you in person? I don't know if you're doing any talks or that sort of thing, about your book as well.
Okay, well, thank you. So I don't have a website of my own, but I regularly publish on RT, on the op-edge section of the RT website, sometimes contribute to Middle East Eye, and I've got an article coming out in the next few days on Telesur on this very issue. And my book's called Divide and Ruin, The West Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis, and that is available online from Amazon, or people can email me at danglazebrook2000@yahoo.co.uk, I can send you a copy myself, as I'm sure there are people who don't necessarily want to support Amazon. So, yeah, that's another option.
Okay, Dan Glazebrook, journalist and author, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Many thanks.
Now, Mernaz Shahabi, you're sitting there patiently, you're chipping in from time to time, but I wonder if you can give us a picture of some of, because one of the most confusing things about this conflict in Syria is the number of different sort of rebel groups that there are, and it doesn't seem like it's just like the ISIS and the Free Syrian Army anymore. We're getting told, given all sorts of terms to refer to the various different groups in Syria, al-Nusra. I wonder if you can just help clear that one up a little bit.
Well, yes, I've actually been discussing this with my Syrian friends to try to understand about these different groups. There are so many. As far as the Free Syrian Army is concerned, it was really disbanded in early 2013, if it ever really existed in any form. Or it was sort of dissolved into these jihadi groups, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda groups. Now, there are three main groups. One is al-Nusra, which is really an offshoot of al-Qaeda. Now, there's the Ahrar al-Sham, which is another jihadist group, very violent, and its leader has been al-Qaeda, and there are al-Qaeda members in it. And the other one, Jaish al-Islam, which is, again, hardline Islamists. And its leader, actually, in January, it threatened to bomb Damascus with hundreds of missiles, and actually warned it said to the Sunni population to stay inside, and said our targets are the Alawites and the Christians and other minorities. So these are supposed to be the moderate rebels that British government is supporting.
Well, that sounds like a bit of a gesture, doesn't it? Because, I mean, if they're saying you people stay inside and everyone else go outside, people are obviously not going to do that if they think the missiles
are
coming.
They actually did launch a missile attack, not then, but after a while. And they killed quite a number of people and injured many. And the other one is, of course, the Jaish al-Mujahideen, which is composed of many Chechen fighters. They are basically foreign fighters. But all these groups, what they have in common is that they are being funded by Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. And they are full of mercenaries. So in no way they are representing true Syrian opposition. They are terrorists.
I think that's right. There are many of them are from outside Syria. That's quite clear.
Yes. Yeah.
Many of them have come in via Turkey. And of course, what the Russians have been pointing out since their plane has been shot down is that this is the main way in which these people have come into Syria, and the main way in which they're supplied, armed, and their finances are sorted out. And of course, what the Syrian Arab Army, the Kurdish militias, and the Russian Air Force are doing is closing down that supply line. And that's why their plane was shot down by Erdogan. And, of course, he didn't do it without clearing it with Obama. And Obama said Turkey has got the right to defend its airspace, completely avoiding the point that the plane wasn't in their airspace. And in any case, you're not allowed to shoot planes down or enter into your airspace by accident anyway. And, of course, from the Russian point of view, as Lavrov pointed out, is the only way they could have shot it down is because we, in, out of the goodness of our hearts, have been telling NATO exactly what we're up to in Syria, giving you full details of all of our flight plans and everything, so that we don't have any silly accidents. This wasn't a silly accident. This is a deliberate provocation.
Oh, it's an ambush,
but
wasn't it?
It puts the Russians in a very, and the Syrians in a very difficult position. Because if they don't respond, then people within Syria will think that they are weak and that they can't respond and they don't dare to respond and that they will therefore be put on the back foot. If they do respond, they will then be accused of escalating the situation.
Yes, well, I noticed one of the comments from the Russian leader Vladimir Putin this week was, well, the Turks have invited us to a war, but we have declined.
Well, the other thing, of course, we haven't mentioned is the downing of the Russian airliner in Egypt. And I've read suggestions that that wasn't carried out by ISIS, but carried out by intelligence services based in Qatar.
Yeah.
Which is quite likely, I think. And I think also that the bombing of the Syrian army a couple of days ago, the Americans are saying it wasn't us, we were nowhere near. And the suggestion I've made to me is that there was a Qatari Air Force that carried out that.
But also, at the end of last week, wasn't it actually just before our last show we did, I missed this because it was hardly reported, the Israelis also flew a sortie down to Damascus, just literally the same evening as the British voted. So in a way, what we're doing is providing cover for something the Israelis have been wanting to do for the last 30 or 40 years.
What was really irritating to me about the so-called debate in Parliament about all of this, that the discussions of the geopolitical implications if the RAF are shot down by a Russian missile on a bombing mission in support of al-Jaish al-Mujahideen or whatever, what are the implications of that? What if the pilot's captured? What are we going to do then?
I mean, are we in a situation...
No discussion about any
Martin,
of that.
But aren't we in a situation now where this is just about literally survival of the fittest, rule by force, law of the jungle in
Absolutely. I think gloves are off. I think that gloves are off. I mean, there was no real discussion about the legality of this intervention. And also what I was particularly disappointed about this debate in Parliament was there was no discussion, nothing even from Jeremy Corbyn or any of the MPs, about what right does Britain have to carry out regime change operation that it has been calling for in another country, in a sovereign country? I mean, this is against international law. Why didn't anyone bring this up?
I think we shouldn't lose sight of international law as a lodestar here. That's what the Russians are doing and the Syrian government. You're not obeying the law, but we're not going to stoop to your level. And I think that's the correct response by them.
One thing that I wanted to mention was actually in relation to the Turkmens that are saying that the Russians have been bombing the Syrian Turkmens. And it has been found out that the leader of the Turkmens there has been actually a Turkish citizen. He's the son of a mayor in a province in Turkey.
He's also an activist in the Grey Wolves, which are
absolutely
a banned terrorist group inside Turkey, frequently used by MIT, the Turkish intelligence.
So are you implying here, Martin, that a group that's banned in Turkey, a Grey Wolves right-wing terrorist group of some sort, which is banned in Turkey, is out now and managing to thrive across the border over in Syria?
In Syria.
Indeed it is, and they're working very closely with Turkish intelligence services. Now, in other words, none of this background to the actual conflict was discussed in the debate, and of course the main opposition for Corbyn and others was to say, oh well, it's very complicated, we don't want to bomb because we might kill civilians. All true, but of course what they really should have been saying, hang on a minute, Britain is actually in the dock here for starting the war in Syria. Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, pointed the finger at Britain And I'm sure, quite sure that there are people in British Special Forces who've been in Turkey, who've been in Jordan, who've been working with these very groups that we are bombing.
Now, one of the main reasons which was given in the debate last week in the House of Commons, in fact, the main reason, was the attack on Paris, and this was seen as a reaction to that. So I asked Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire what he made of those.
The Paris attacks, you look at what's come out of it. It's shutting down European borders, talk about free society is a bad thing, freedom of movement is a bad thing. We need to launch more, send more troops, more military assets to the Middle East to fight ISIS, when in fact the Paris attacks, there is no real forensic case, Tony, that puts ISIS in Paris, just as there is no actual forensic case that puts ISIS in the Sinai blowing up the Russian plane, nor ISIS in Beirut with the recent Beirut bombings, and or San Bernardino. So, but yet you hear these all rattled off in a list by politicians and media people as if it's like a script that they have to basically repeat this checklist of ISIS has now got a global reach. And a lot of this can be definitely be an illusion, Tony. I like looking at the forensic case. And in the case of San Bernardino, we can't put the the female shooter, especially at the scene of the shooting. No one can ID her. They said they're wearing masks. She's a 5'4", 120-pound Pakistani housewife. The likelihood of her carrying body armor and a full tactical package and firing a .223 automatic Smith & Wesson rifle is a laughable scenario. Yet this is what is put across as the official story.
Has anybody positively identified them at the scene actually doing the shooting?
No, they haven't. This is something about this case, Tony, that's been glossed over. You could potentially ID a male of a certain, 5'11", 6', because they're both supposedly masked. The reports are the shooters were masked. So there's no support to the idea that the wife, the Muslim housewife who is cooking chicken korma for her husband is going to be G.I. Jane overnight, just like there is no forensic evidence to put anybody from Syria at the Paris shootings. We do have a fake Syrian passport, which by all intents and purposes looks to be planted at the scene. And also a German minister agrees with me on that. But the talking point, Tony, was that the migrant crisis bled into cause a terrorist event in the heart of Europe. That was the narrative. And they acted immediately. And all these sort of policies are coming into place fast and furious. To me, Paris looks like a classic Gladio-style event. And if you look at the policies and the political objectives that were achieved from Paris, it's almost identical in a way to what Gladio sought to achieve through its activities and through various proxy groups and whatever terrorist groups, political extremist factions and so forth. So instead of working through communist parties or the extreme political left or right in Europe, they're just basically using the illusion of Islamic extremist terrorist groups in order to sort of perform the same exact acts, basically.
Well, it's interesting that Patrick mentions Gladio there. We talk about that quite frequently on this programme. It's not as if these kind of false flag attacks are some kind of new phenomenon. There is overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have carried out acts of terrorism within Western European countries, killing innocent civilians in order to create certain political effects. And this is because of the investigations by the Italian police force over 30 years. The head of the Italian Supreme Court, the retired head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, has written a book about this, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, where on the basis he was the investigating magistrate on many of these events. The evidence is overwhelming that NATO is a terrorist organization.
Patrick was talking there about the San Bernardino shootings. Yep. I've seen several very credible articles now, many eyewitnesses, even journalists now, saying that it looks like there were three shooters, not two shooters, and even photographs.
There's various eyewitnesses, and they've been on the mainstream media in the US saying that, well, there were three shooters, and they were all wearing camo, and they all looked like pros, which is very much similar to what happened in Paris, where the people who were all dead are all drug addicts, dope fiends, the boozers and mental health cases, who happen to be Muslims, they're all dead.
It doesn't seem to
and
be
the
any...
various people who actually did all the shooting
the other
have disappeared into
characteristic
the
is it doesn't seem to be any kind of judicial process going to happen in Paris or in San Bernardino.
Well, indeed, that
everyone
is very
being...
suspicious, isn't it? You'd have thought all... when an incident like that happens that it would take ages to work out what has actually happened and to find the timelines and all the rest
of it. Also, it seems, moving towards a shoot-to-kill policy here in Britain, which was very controversial when it was talked about in Northern Ireland, but it's happening day after day now. Police often killing people rather than actually trying to arrest them. Well, anyway, Mayor, I wonder what you make of this the accusations of potential false flags with mercenaries, special forces being used to carry out these attacks, and then patsies, people being basically fitted up for them.
Well, as I said before, whether they are false flag operations, I'm sure many of them are. Like, for example, it's very interesting that passports are found in these locations. Do terrorists who want to carry out terrorist actions carry passports with them? But even if some of them are not false flag operations, they are not justifications for attack on a sovereign state. You see, the attack on a sovereign state is going to just increase the sense of resentment. And all these jihadists are all over the place. So that is not going to stem the tide of terrorism.
It's a bit difficult, isn't it, to actually think, well, what would be the purpose of doing this? But I asked Patrick Henningsen finally about what he thought was the big agenda behind all this.
Oil's a part of it. Gas is maybe a bigger part of it than even oil is in terms of sub-regional dominance. Gas is emerged as incredibly important in that respect. Certainly Syria is sitting on top of great deposits. There's a report that just came out that showed that this had been proven in 2005, and all of a sudden we saw hostilities being ramped up after that. But oil and gas, plus we have the military industry, Tony, that in itself is a juggernaut now. This is a multi-hundreds trillion-dollar global industry. That's a juggernaut. We have so many different factors that feed into this. Plus, you have the socio-economic, plus the religious aspects of it. You have old power plays, old geographic power plays of the Halford Mackinder flavor with Eurasia. Plus, we have the situation with Israel, and you have to look at Israel. Everyone's turned their head away from what's been going on in Jerusalem and the West Bank because of this latest crisis. So, again, that's ongoing. That's not stopping, nor is the battle for the Sinai Peninsula. That's an ongoing. We still have peacekeepers in the Sinai, U.S. troops, 700 of them, to basically watch what Egypt and Israel are doing in the Sinai Peninsula. So still today, after all these years. So these are all live plays, as is Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of pressure on the Saudi monarchy right now, too, on many fronts. And I there's noises coming out of CIA that, I quote, the Saudi royal family is not long for this world. End of quote. I heard that last week from a CIA operative.
Well, what I also see is that this long-time plan of the Balkanization of the region is being carried out. For example, now we hear about this Sunnistan in Iraq, with Turkey invading Iraq and allying with the corrupt Kurdish regional government in Kurdistan, trying to basically, they are going there to stay, and they are claiming it's that sort of pre-Ottoman, the Ottoman Empire dream of expansionism. Now they are trying to recover the parts of Syria that they believe belong to them and parts of Iraq that they believe to belong to them, and together with the Kurds to create a Sunni region, a Sunni country that will be under their thumb. And the same thing is happening in Syria as well, breaking the region up, breaking the country up into Sunni, Shia, Kurds. So I see that that project is being carried out. But also it is the question of the energy, the massive amounts of energy which has been found in the Eastern Mediterranean, 1.8 billion barrels of oil.
Well, perhaps that's what most of this
122 trillion cubic feet of
gas. I'll just ask you to pick up on one point that Dan made there, which we sort of let hang in the air. Are we at war with Russia?
Effectively, yes. But I think what I said earlier, the way the Russians are handling this is we are not going to break international law just because you do. They are actually playing for a rejigging of the international system so that international law, currently completely ignored, becomes a viable force. And that, of course, is a rational strategy because the vast majority of humanity eventually will realise who is the defenders of legality and who isn't. And, of course, on that basis, I'd just like to mention the chemical weapons attack 2 years ago at Ghouta. Not only was it not carried out by the Assad regime, the evidence showed it was carried out by NATO.
I noticed the
China. So we killed those children. That's a red line.
Also, China has weighed in, hasn't it, saying that it wants there to be an anti-ISIS massive coalition, including possibly the rebels too.
Well, in actual fact, the Turkmen mentioned earlier, they are basically from outside Syria, and they're basically Turkic-speaking people, some of which are based in the Uyghur region in China, and they have terrorist attacks being carried out in, separatist terrorist attacks being carried out in China by Turkish militants, who are armed and trained by the Turkish military. And the Turkish, the Grey Wolves were also, and that's what we're talking about here, were also responsible for the attack on the Hindu temple in Thailand some while ago. That's what the Thai police are saying.
So I think what you're saying from my question at the top of the hour is that the West and the NATO alliance does pose a danger to humanity.
World War III has already started. Let's hope the imperialists lose. They deserve to.
Okay, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Iranian-born Bristolian anti-war campaigner Mehrnaz Shahabi and journalist Dan Glazebrook, author of Divide and Ruin. Our sister show Dialect's been dropped from BCFM, but it's still available as a podcast, and you can hear our special on the withdrawal of funding from the St Paul's Carnival too. That's at this dialectradio1word.co.uk. This show is at thisweek.org.uk, where you can hear links and hear previous shows. I'm Tony Gosling on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable despite all this weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week, the last one before Christmas, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we are pleased to repeat some excerpts from a recent discussion at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco. The speakers at this historic event were authors David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott, both of whom have been previous guests here on the Project Censored Show. David Talbot's new book is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Stay tuned to the Project Censored Show as we finish KPFA's Winter Fun Drive. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. This is the final day of KPFA's fund drive, and we are happy to be here supporting Free Speech Radio, and we have some wonderful premiums as thank you gifts for you today. This is the Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We have the book for a $150 pledge. We have a recent DVD of David Talbot from October where he's talking about his research and new book. And we have, really kind of hot off the presses, we have the CD, the audio version of the talk that David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott had at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco only 2 weeks ago. That's a $75 pledge. You can get the CD and book for $200. You can get the Deep State Combo Pack for $300. But most importantly, you get the satisfaction of knowing that you're a member of KPFA and that you support Free Speech Radio and the Project Censored Show. So please keep calls coming in throughout the hour. We have some wonderful volunteers in the phone room. 800-439-5732 is the number to call. David Talbot founded the website Salon.com. He was an editor at Mother Jones Magazine. He's written for Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, and other publications. His earlier books include Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and his newest book is The Devil's Chessboard, where Talbot examines the post-World War II world through the career of U.S. lawyer, diplomat, and spymaster Alan Dulles, the younger brother of John Foster Dulles. He was in conversation at the Mechanics Institute a couple weeks ago with Peter Dale Scott. He's a retired Canadian diplomat, professor emeritus of English at UC Berkeley. He's a prolific author. His most recent book is Dallas 63, which was an e-book on the Kennedy assassination. His most recent hardcover book is The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. Peter Dale Scott writes extensively about deep state issues, secret government issues, this de facto government that exists alongside the elected one. We're going to share excerpts from the talk between Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot with you this afternoon. This took place December 2nd at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco. And here we are. We're going to roll several of these cuts and pitch between, and we hope that you will be enticed by what you hear and that you will call in. So here is the first clip right now in this excerpt of the discussion. David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott describe what Dulles was up to when he was in Europe in World War II.
I think most people know that if they know anything about Alan Dulles, they know that during World War II he was in Bern, and on his own and against instructions from the White House, negotiated a separate peace with the general in charge of the army in Italy and Western Austria at a time when Roosevelt had agreed with Churchill and Stalin for unconditional surrender. Now, you note correctly, and this is a quote from your book, that by negotiating with the SS general, Dulles was clearly violating FDR's emphatic policy of unconditional surrender. And then you go on elsewhere to write about, quote, Alan Dulles's reign of treason as America's top spy in Nazi-occupied Europe. Well, that is a pretty serious charge, and maybe you want to say a bit about it.
Well, I would go so far to say that if you look at the intelligence history of this country from World War II on, and at men like Alan Dulles, who are the legends of American intelligence, in some ways is the godfather of modern American intelligence, you see that treason is built into their very fiber. Because they say this quite openly in their various statements that I quote in the book. He and his brother, John Foster Dulles, who became Secretary of State under Eisenhower, they believed that democracy was too important to be left in the hands of mere people like you and me and our elected representatives. So it was their duty, as people who knew better, who represented the most elite forces in American society, to pursue their own policies, whether or not they happened to correspond with the policies of our leaders, including the president, whoever was president at the time. And this, I began the book, you're right, Peter, talking about the Nazi era. And to me, this was one of the most flagrant examples of this, because here you have clearly, for most people, a clear-cut case of good versus evil. You know, you have the Western allies coming together to defeat this unprecedented historical evil in the Hitler regime. And yet, the Dulles brothers, and not just them, I don't want to like single them out above, their group. We're talking about people in Wall Street, people at the top level of American, the corporate world, Standard Oil, General Motors. Many of these companies, many of these executives had long-standing relations with German companies, even as they morphed into being part of the Nazi regime. Talking about IG Farben, the notorious chemical company that produced Zyklon B that was used to exterminate Jews. I'm talking about...
And the slave labor camps. And slave labor Auschwitz, camps. Yes.
The Krupp Steel conglomerate that, of course, was an instrumental part of the Nazi war machine, and a number of others. So these companies were corporate clients of the Dulles brothers. They were giving the head, Hermann Schmidt, who was head of IG Farben and later was put on trial for war crimes, was actually exchanging cheery Christmas cards with the Dulles brothers and others as he was producing Zyklon B in the early days of the war. And these relations continued seamlessly as Dulles has himself sent to Switzerland during the war. Why not London, where most of the OSS is headquartered? Because I believe Switzerland, of course, is the financial haven for the Nazi financial machine. They're using Swiss-based banks to launder their loot that they're expropriating from Europe as they conquer Europe. And Alan Dulles wants to continue to be there, so he's in position to represent these German clients and American clients, and be in a position, I think, to try to preserve what he feels is most viable about the German regime after the war as a bulwark against the Soviet Union.
Yeah, which, can I pick up?
Yes, go ahead.
I don't think it was a personal motive, you know, what's good for Sullivan and Cromwell. I do think that Alan Dulles, and not he alone by any means, was very worried about what would Germany be after it had been destroyed in the war, that the chances that it would go communist were very great. And added to that, you know, Roosevelt, who came out of this establishment, deep state milieu of Wall Street, had become a very bitter opponent of it, as was Truman after him. And he was quite willing to have, he allowed his Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau, who was Jewish, to come up with a plan for post-war Germany, which was to eliminate German industry and turn it back into three or four small states growing potatoes. He felt that wouldn't work, and I must say, I don't think it would have worked either. But it was policy. At the Quebec conference, a sort of modified, slightly scaled back version of the Morgenthau plan was Roosevelt's policy, and Dulles was dead set on the idea that we have to act with the traditional element, not necessarily Nazis. A lot of them became Nazi, and the Nazis had become part of the fabric. Despite what some people say, I don't think he was trying to save Nazis per se. He was trying to save the German ruling class, or shall we say the German deep state, because they had a deep state there. And so this led to all kinds of dealings, and in my view, Sunrise was important for the surrender of troops in Italy, but which didn't change the war at all. It was 6 days before the total surrender.
Operation Sunrise was Alan Dulles' scheme to cut a separate peace deal with Nazi forces in Italy, and to hold off the Red Army from getting into northern Italy.
If there was ever a sign that Dulles was running his own policy and not the White House policy, it was doing this thing which was dead set opposed to White House policy.
That's the voice of Peter Dale Scott. He's in conversation with David Talbot. They're discussing Talbot's newest book, The Devil's Chessboard. The Devil's Chessboard looks at the life of Alan Dulles, looks at his career at the CIA as the longest-serving director there, and Talbot talks about the rise of America's secret government. Of course, Peter Dale Scott, longtime expert and prolific author regarding matters of the deep state. And Peter Dale Scott, he talks about America's increasing militarization, restrictions on constitutional rights, and all kinds of things, of course, that have come out of a lot of this secret government activity. He writes a lot about that in his book, The American Deep State. David Talbot kind of goes into the whole history of the rise of that deep state in the United States, and you just heard an excerpt from that historic conversation they had at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco earlier this month, and you can get that audio for $75 by supporting Free Speech Radio. Call 800-439-5732 and get a copy of this historic discussion between these towering deep state scholars, Peter Dale Scott, David Talbot. You could get the Devil's Chessboard book by David Talbot for $150. You can get the DVD of Talbot's talk that he did for KPFA in October about the Devil's Chessboard. You can get the CD and book for $200. You can get the Deep State Combo Pack for $300. That's everything we have here. That's the CD audio of this recent talk, which you cannot get anywhere else. You can get the Devil's Chessboard book, the Talbot talk, but we really just need you to call in and show that you support Free Speech Radio's Project Censored Show, and you really care about this kind of information. This is the kind of information that you're not going to get elsewhere. The New York Times just came out the other day and basically said that they're not going to review David Talbot's Devil's Chessboard, taking a page out of the CIA playbook in the 60s when they wouldn't review. The newspapers were told not to review, and the Mockingbird reporters told not to review books that challenge the efficacy of the Warren Commission report. And here we are in the 21st century, Mockingbird Redux, still the big media players trying to ignore David Talbot's work, Peter Dale Scott's work as well. But you can help get that word out. You can get these untold stories out there by calling 800-439-5732 online at kpfa.org. Peter?
There's some really amazing content in this book, The Devil's Chessboard. I mean, it's 600 pages. I read it last month. It's really appalling. And it was one little episode here about Dulles when he was a young diplomat stationed in Turkey after World War I. Someone handed him a copy of the Protocol of the Elders of Zion, which had been totally discredited at that time, had been put together by the Tsar's anti-Semitic secret police as a document that claimed there was a Jewish plot for world domination. And it had whether lurid tales about Passover feasts and a variety of terrible things. Completely false, completely uncredible. But Dulles took it seriously enough to write a coded report about the secret Jewish plot to the world back to his superiors in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, this book is rich with that kind of deep detail of the degrees to which his formation, his life, and how he became head of the CIA, bringing all of that with him. And it's certainly something to understand and have an awareness of in terms of being an American citizen, an American person in this world today. That history is vital to understand. And you can get a really good piece of it by picking up the book for a $150 pledge by calling 1-800-439-5732. You can get the talk that we're playing now, which is David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott in Berkeley on December 2nd, where they're really discussing the book and all the implications thereof. That's a $75 pledge. You can get the CD and the book together for a $200 pledge. These are amazing premiums, and you can pick them up right now by calling 1-800-439-5732. We need you to do this. This is a Project Censored Show. Mickey and I come down every Friday as volunteers from the North Bay, and we produce this show, which airs on 27 stations across the country. And so KPFA is the foundation for the kinds of things that we're doing. And we need to raise money today for KPFA. We're down to about $100,000, and we're going to try to get as close to as we can. We've already raised $250,000 in the last two weeks. And today we need you to call in and really support our show. Our best ever hour was 7,000. I'd sure like to hit that. So everybody listening today, if you haven't yet contributed, or even if you have, please call in and make a contribution at KPFA 1-800-439-5732. You can pick up these great premiums as part of that process. You can support the Project Censored Show and our national efforts in terms of getting this kind of information out. And we really need your help.
That's right. Call 800-439-5732 to get these wonderful thank you gifts, these premiums. And again, these are the kinds of things that you really don't hear anywhere else. Of course, David Talbot's been making some rounds, but as I mentioned earlier, he's kind of getting the cold shoulder from establishment media, and that's exactly why KPFA is here, because you can't count on the plutocratic mouthpieces and commercial broadcasting systems. You need community radio, and we have it right here at KPFA. 800-439-5732 is the number to call. KPFA.org online. You can pledge there as well. $300 for the Deep State Combo Pack. $200 gets you the CD and the book. You can get the DVD of Talbot for $100. You can get one for $150. This amazing, nearly 700-page book, The Devil's Chessboard. Alan Dulles, The Rise of the CIA, Alan Dulles, The Rise of America's Secret Government. And you can also get this great audio. We're going to share this some more with you right now. Definitely as a teaser, because we want you to call 800-439-5732 to call and get this audio. You're not going to get this anywhere else. It is not anywhere else. This is an exclusive premium made available by David Talbot, Peter Dale Scott, and the people at the Mechanics Institute. $75 gets you that historic talk. So keep the calls coming, 800-439-5732. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We're sharing with you excerpts from this historic talk at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco with David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott. The whole discussion is about 90 minutes, but let's hear one of the questions and answers. And this one is related to Alan Dulles' World War II activities in Switzerland.
Yes, David, I'd like to go back to World War II. In your book, you mentioned a number of times about the Bank for International Settlements, and Alan Dulles was in Bern, and the Bank for International Settlements continued to meet in Rougemont near Gstaad during the war and socialized. The Japanese, the Germans, the Italians all socialized with their wives. How implemented is Alan Dulles in moving the Nazi gold around through the Bank of International Settlements to
finance? Well, he's key. It's a great question. You asked about the Bank of International Settlements, which was a key institution, the key Nazi financial institution during World War II. So the Bank of International Settlements is this obscure institution that goes back to the post-World War I days when it was set up by the central banks of Europe and the United States to administer German reparations payments after World War I. And it kind of morphs into a Nazi bank by the war, World War II. With an American president, strangely. Thomas McKittrick, who's a very close friend of Dulles. And so Thomas McKittrick is seen as basically a traitor, as a treasonous agent by the Roosevelt administration. And when he comes home from Switzerland to visit and is feted by his corporate friends, the Waldorf Astoria or some party, I think, no, the University Club, they basically try to arrest him, the Roosevelt administration, and keep him in the U.S.
Treasury Department.
Morgan. The Treasury Department, Henry Morgenthau again. Again, the Dulles brothers ride to his rescue. The Alan Dulles pulls strings, and a few months later, McKittrick is back in Switzerland, and he's, you know, venting about, oh, these fellows in the Roosevelt administration, they don't like me because I talk to the Germans and Italians. I happen to say that the Germans and Italians are fine fellows. I mean, he literally had no moral compass, these
and
people.
And didn't he talk about the mean types in the Treasury Department?
Exactly, that they were harassing him and so on. So, yeah, you know, the Bank of International Settlements, a very key institution. It did indeed launder Nazi treasure. In fact, as the head of the Reichsbank said, it was the only overseas financial mechanism that the Nazis had during the war.
That is David Talbot in conversation with Peter Dale Scott. That talk took place earlier this month at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're sharing excerpts with you today in hopes that you'll call 800-439-5732 and that you will get this audio recording of an historic conversation about our history and the history of America's deep state. David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott were discussing Talbot's newest book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. You can get that book for a $150 pledge. You can get the David Talbot talk for KPFA that he did earlier in October for a $100 pledge. $200 gets you the CD and the book. The Deep State Combo Pack, $300. That'll make Peter Phillips and I quite happy if we can move a few of those combo packs out the door. Not just are we getting this vital information out into the community and sharing it with others, but you're helping support Free Speech Radio on the last day of this fund drive. 800-439-5732 is the number to call.
After the war, there were no consequences for Dulles for defying the policies of a president. Indeed, in early 1953, Dulles was appointed director of the CIA. In this next excerpt, David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott discuss Operation Ajax, the 1953 coup against Iran, or the toppling of Iranian President Mossadegh, in which a democratically elected prime minister, he was overthrown, and Mossadegh was overthrown, and the Shah was installed in his place. Here is that clip.
So much of the book is extremely relevant to the situation that America finds itself in today. But I thought it would be a good idea to hear you say something about 1953. This is the first CIA violent covert operation against another country, against a democracy, actually, the destruction of the democracy and its replacement by a dictatorship. And it's, I think, relevant to today in many, many different ways. But I'd like to hear you tell us something about why is it important now?
Well, absolutely. The coup that overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, we're still dealing with the unending ramifications from that. You know, the CIA was delighted about this great success as they saw at the time. And according to one internal CIA document that I quote in the book, they said it was a day that should never have ended, because it was such a great and unmitigated success. And of course, it is a day that has never ended, not in the sense that the CIA analyst meant, of course, but it's a day that we're still paying for over and over again, and the people of Iran, of course. You know, it drives me wild whenever we have a terror attack like Paris, when the so-called experts, and the wonderful host described me and Peter as national security expert. I don't put myself in the category of all these men, and 99% of them are men that are trotted out on television after something like Paris. I think we all have to become our own national security experts at this point, if we really want to make this a viable democracy. But, you know, when they say again and again, we've heard this since Bush, I think, first said it back in right after 9/11, they hate us for our democracy. What's appalling to me, of course, is that we hated them for their democracy in the case of Iran in 1953. And that's clearly what stimulated that anti-democratic action, is when Mohammad Mossadegh and his National Front movement tried to assert sovereignty over the oil resources of that nation, first taking on, of course, the enormous power of the British oil industry, the company that later became British Petroleum. And then when they reached out to the U.S. for help, of course, the Dulles brothers got involved. The Dulles brothers had a long history of representing the oil industry, the American oil industry, and the British oil industry. And they convinced a dubious, initially, President Eisenhower that Mossadegh was indeed a communist threat. He wasn't. In fact, the Communist Party of Iran was very skeptical of him because he seemed enamored of U.S. democracy. And he'd reached out in great innocence at one point, this is Mossadegh after being elected, to a recently elected Eisenhower, and implored him to live up to America's democratic ideals and intervene with the British allies and say, stop this blockade, this economic blockade that Britain had imposed on Iran after they nationalized their oil. And initially, Eisenhower was open to working in a cooperative way with the Mossadegh government.
A bit more about that.
Go ahead.
The operation against Mossadegh really began in 1951 with a plot cooked up by MI6, the British equivalent. And for, so it's 3 years, 1951, 52, 53. And the core of it was a successful boycott of Iranian oil that involved not just the British oil companies, but what they called the Seven Sisters. There were five big American international oil corporations, two British, what we call now BP. It was then originally Anglo-Persian, then Anglo-Iranian, and the other one, of course, Shell. Well, it's illegal in America to have a cartel arrangement, and Truman was planning very much to go after those oil companies for precisely what they were doing to Iran. What Enron did to California in 2000, they were, the Seven Sisters were doing big time to the whole world. And they just told everybody, you cannot buy Iranian oil. And a little Italian ship went in there, tried to do it, the Royal Navy. I spent so much time on this because you will read over and over and over that the CIA overthrew Mossadegh. The CIA came in the final stage, but it was the British government, the British Navy, and above all, this Seven Sisters International Oil Cartel that Truman had in his sights. He was planning to bring criminal charges against them, and they were saved by the election because the Eisenhower administration said, well, we'll give this whole problem to the State Department. That was John Foster Dulles from the oil firm, from the law company, Sullivan and Cromwell, that was representing the oil cartel in the case. So it was allowed to die. And that we have, I'd like to say, we're living today under the permanent consequences of that, that big international corporations in this matter prevailed over governments.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips with Mickey Huff, and we're listening with a talk recorded earlier this month at the Mechanic Institute Library in San Francisco with author David Talbot is speaking about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of the American Secret Government. Talbot's speaking with Peter Dale Scott. He's a theorist on the deep state. We've interviewed him many times on this show. This is very important material. Talbot talked about early on in his book when Dulles was rising to power about C. Wright Mills and the power elite and the triumphant of political, military, and corporate power in the United States after World War II. That had been ongoing even before. And then, of course, the creation of the CIA, which Truman later called the American Gestapo because of our involvements both in Guatemala, in Iran, and other places around the world, assassinations, all done rather secretly or denied in terms of that. And then, of course, both Peter Dale and David Talbot go on to implicate the CIA in the murder of Robert John Kennedy and Bob Kennedy, in the 60s. Those are very important ways to understand U.S. history. There is a deep state. Now, that transition from a national deep state to now a transnational deep state, so that the corporate power in the world, the transnational corporate class, is being served by the American empire, and the U.S. has 130 countries where we have special forces operating right now. So this is a global empire power. To understand that, you need this history, the devil's chessboard, that takes us right up from the beginning, then into Peter Dale Scott's material, and all of this is available and for you to read by calling 1-800-439-5732. You get the message here on KPFA and Project Censored, but these books, this material, the CD that you can pick up for $75, the book for $150, a DVD talk by David Talbot at KPFA for $100, or a combination pack for $200 or $300. We need your help right now.
We're at the halfway mark for the show, and we need to raise a few thousand dollars. We've already done, in the last 2 weeks, over $340,000. So please keep the calls coming, 1-800-439-5732. You can do it online, kpfa.org. You can ask for the Deep State Combo Pack. That's all that we have here today, the CD, the book, the DVD, it's David Talbot, it's Peter Dale Scott, it's the Devil's Chessboard book, it's the talk. There's a lot of material here, and you just heard Peter talking, kind of laying out this important history, this untold history. This is absolutely not only crucial and vital information, it's actually riveting for people who are unaware that these kinds of things take place, this deep state operation. You know, they were just listening to David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott talk about Operation Ajax. That actually did involve the CIA as well as British intelligence, Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, a CIA agent involved there. These stories are unfortunately plentiful, and they go all the way through the 20th century, and they come all the way through to the present. Certainly Peter Dale Scott has done a masterful job of that in his research in American deep state issues. But David Talbot, he really kind of gives us the in-depth look at what the CIA coming out of the Office of Strategic Services, the USS in World War II and how all this secret, this deep state business got started, right? And several presidents, you know, just after this happened, you know, they had second thoughts. They were wondering what was going on. You know, Truman had second thoughts. Eisenhower, of course, warned people about the military-industrial complex. That's the deep state kind of operation right there, people. And then, of course, Kennedy wanted to get rid of Dulles and said he wanted to get rid of the CIA. And, of course, ultimately what happened is that they got rid of JFK. But you can learn more about this vital parts, these vital parts of our history that are influential all the way up to the present. Call 800-439-5732. Join Gail in San Rafael. Thank you so much, Gail, for your pledge to the Project Censored Show and for your compliment. We seriously appreciate that. Also, Chris in Healdsburg, thank you so much for calling in and getting this historic talk between David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott. Won't you be the next person to get that and share that with people as we go into the new year? 800-439-5732 is the number to call. 800-439-5732. You can pledge online at kpfa.org, but we really need to keep the calls coming in. This is the final day of the KPFA Fund Drive, and Peter and I want to go out with a bang here. We really hope that we're going to be able to meet our goal, and we appreciate all those who have called in. There's wonderful volunteers in the phone room waiting to take your call. 800-439-5732. Peter?
1-800-439-5732. We need you to call right now. There's just a few hours left in this fund drive. This is the Project Censored Show every Friday at 1 o'clock. Then it airs on 27 stations across the country this next week. And we are very excited about that. And we use the KPFA studios to record and present this information to you. We need this station to be intact. The country needs this station to be intact. You need this station to be intact. And we ask you to contribute right now. If you haven't done yet, or even if you have, please call in 1-800-439-5732. The deep state is a very important concept for America today. We have an empire. We have 1,000 bases worldwide. We're engaging in repression of democratic governments all over the world. We're killing people with drones. And you need to have a full understanding of where this has come from and to what degree this deep state that's not in the newspapers. That's why the New York Times won't review this book. But this is a book documented with 60 pages of footnotes in great detail. This is academic. It's fully awareness. And this is a kind of information that we address, we read, and we try to bring to you on this radio show.
That's right, Peter. And, you know, the Bay Area is full of so many amazing people that contribute to our dialogue, our discourse, and our political understanding. Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot, Bay Area folks. And we're definitely getting some North Bay support here today. Benson and Mill Valley, thank you so much for joining Gail and San Rafael and Chris and Healdsburg. Keep the calls coming, folks. 800-439-5732 is that number. 800-439-5732. KPFA.org online. Now, we're going to hear another excerpt from this historic talk between David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott about the Devil's Chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the rise of America's secret government. In this excerpt, David Talbot takes note of how major U.S. media supported the coup against Mossadegh in Iran and later the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala.
You know, the other people I want to call out here, speaking of sort of the corporate takeover of Iran in those years, is the American media, starting with the New York Times and the Washington Post. They were a big part of the kind of paving the way and giving a rationale for why this coup had to happen. It was covered, if you go back and look at the New York Times in the most appalling way, as not a overthrow of democracy, but as the overthrow of a madman, the overthrow of a communist sympathizer, the overthrow of someone who was putting the country at risk rather than had the support of his people, clear support, overwhelming support. And so the rhetoric of the New York Times, the rhetoric of the Washington Post is that this was a heroic action. And again, you see this throughout the Dulles era, where the New York Times, the Washington Post, Newsweek, Time, of course, the Luce Empire under Henry Luce, these people were all very socially close and politically close to Allen Dulles and his crowd. And literally, they followed the CIA line on these coups from one place to the next, whether it was Iran, Guatemala, the Congo, even today. I mean, it still continues to, and I'll shut up and let Peter ask the next question, but it still irritates me today to see the way the New York Times is covering Jeremy Corbyn's efforts as the leader of the British Labour Party to actually have a Democratic debate about whether the UK, Britain, should be bombing, joining in this permanent war that's going on in the Middle East, and now initiate a new wave of bombing in Syria. And so the way he's described in the New York Times a day or so ago is, oh, he's dividing his party, he's reckless, he's inexperienced, even though he's a man of, I think, a little older than myself, maybe a little younger than Peter. And again, sort of, you know, giving the sense that he's an outlier politically. So this is the kind of way that you see the New York Times cover these administrations, these leaders, whenever U.S. interests are in conflict with them.
Yeah, and we should move on, but there's a couple of other things I'd like to point out. Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Theodore, went to Iran to be on the ground. Alan Dulles went to Switzerland to persuade the Shah to go back. He was frightened to go back to the country. Kermit Roosevelt had this brilliant idea, mobilize the mullahs. They politicized the religious mullahs in the countryside and used them as resources. Is this ever a case of the irony of history? That was creating a problem we've had to live with ever since.
Well, a game plan that we used more than once in the Middle East, I think.
Right. For decades, the CIA was using the Muslim Brotherhood as an asset.
Afghanistan, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda.
All over the place, and now the fruit is coming home. Finally, this, of course, everyone in this room, I'm sure, knows what the disaster it was for the history of Iran, just as the Guatemalan event. 1 year later, very similar, overthrow a democracy in order to preserve an American corporation this time.
United Fruit.
United Fruit. Alan Dulles' bank, Schroeder, had an interest in their Anglo-Iranian. They had an interest in United Fruit, that these things, this had global consequences. It was like a precedent. This was telling all the third world countries with oil resources, don't nationalize or see what will happen to you. It redefined America's relationship to the third world in a hostile way, which is terrible in the case of Iran, but is Colombia, all these countries, Venezuela, you name it. It is a real tragedy. Well,
and again,
it didn't have to be. Truman would have done it differently.
That's right. And again, the way that Jacobo Arbenz, the democratically elected leader of Guatemala, was portrayed was as a communist. He was not. He was a nationalist leader who was trying to implement land reform there in this terribly poor country and basically take some land that was not being used by United Fruit, this enormous agribusiness conglomerate that virtually controlled the economies of many countries in Latin America, and give it to peasants to be tilled. You see this game plan again and again. The New York Times correspondent, I believe his name was Sidney Grusin, was driven out at Dulles's insistence. He called up the New York Times editor and said, get rid of this correspondent. He seems to be, too balanced. And so he's driven out, and then the drumbeat begins. You know, he's an extremist. He's getting arms from Czechoslovakia. He has to go. You know, he's a threat in our own hemisphere. And so they are overthrown. And again, it's always done cleanly, right? We hear this with drone strikes, how surgical are. There is no real, there's some collateral damage, but it's acceptable damage. The same thing with Guatemala. It was incredibly clean, the CIA and Dulles tell Eisenhower later. Only a few people died. Well, we now know, of course, that it led to one of the worst killing fields of the 20th century. And the bloodshed went on and on in that country as not only Arbenz was driven to exile, and finally, I believe, assassinated, as his family believed. It was called a suicide at the time, but he was found in a bathtub, scalded to death in Mexico City Hotel years later. But his own people were obviously, the primary victims of this. And farm worker activists, union leaders, journalists, political opposition rounded up, tortured, murdered, death squads roaming the countryside. We have Mary Jo McConaughey here, who's a great journalist who's covered Central America for many, many years, bravely so. Thank you, Mary. Mary Jo, for your work. And so these are the bitter fruit, as it's become known, of the CIA legacy and Alan Dulles. And so it's, to me, again, it's just, I feel like, and Dan Ellsberg was here tonight. Dan, thank you for all your work. You know, we must feel, I mean, I'm sure you feel the way I do sometimes, that we're stuck in this nightmare that goes on and on. You know, the parallels between all these kind of international tragedies and American foreign policy, and it seems like our country never learns from it. We keep repeating these same mistakes over and over.
Indeed we do, and that is David Talbot in conversation with Peter Dale Scott, talking about Talbot's newest book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. You can get that book for a $150 pledge. You can get this conversation, historic conversation, that just took place December at Mechanics Institute in San Francisco for a $75 pledge. You can get David Talbot's talk for KP FA in October for a $100 pledge, the CD and book for $200, the Deep State Combo Pack is a $300 pledge, and we have a match, folks. We have a bona fide match just brought in from the phone room. This person just called in and offered a $300 match, so every dollar now is doubled. So please call 800-439-5732. We have a $300 match on the table, and we would be thrilled if we can get that match met before the end of the hour. In fact, it'd be great if we could get it in the next 8 minutes, because Peter and I want to share a little bit more of this talk with you. It is just a riveting conversation between two towering intellectuals talking about the kind of material that we need to hear about the deep state to understand what's going on in America and around the world today. You're not going to get it on the corporate news airwaves, people. And they were just talking about the media and media complicity in deep state activities, whether it's Operation Mockingbird or PSYOPs. There are concerted efforts, and the CIA has assets in the newsrooms around the United States, right, stemming all the way back from the Mockingbird program. And they were actually instructed to ignore certain authors that questioned official narratives and even attack them by calling them conspiracy theorists. It's the old canard. It's the same tired anti-intellectual labeling that we hear. And frankly, we hear it even too much on the progressive left, which is really kind of a telltale sign that somebody is allergic to critical thinking. So we know that you're not allergic to critical thinking because you're listening to Free Speech Radio, KPFA, and you can get this information by calling 800-439-5732. We've got a $300 match on the table, folks, and we would love to make that match. 800-439-5732. Peter?
I think it's safe to say that the New York Times is censoring the Devil's Chessboard book by Alan Dulles. About Alan Dulles by David Talbot. Because this history is so important, it's so accurate. This is about how the CIA was engineering, assassinating, killing people around the world on behalf of American oil companies, on behalf of the power elite in the United States, and now today on behalf of the transnational corporate class. That's a given. We just can't ignore that. I mean, those concepts are so solid. The research is so firm that anybody that looks at this material has to have an understanding of this is what's really going on, that there is a secret government in the United States, and we don't get told about it, that operates worldwide and does really terrible and awful things, and creating, you know, literally the whole war on terrorism, which is continued justification for that. We ask for your support. We ask that you be able to keep these airways open so that these concepts, these ideas can be talked about by calling 1-800-439-5732 right now. We need your support. We've got about 15 minutes left in the show, and we're really trying to push some records here today. You know, KPFA is coming. You know, we're going to be try to get there as best we can to reach out this fund drive and keep all these doors open and our ability to record here and present this information. This book, The Devil's Chessboard, $150 pledge. The talk that you're listening to, the CD, $75 pledge, both together for $200. Or the DVD with David Talbot when he spoke in October in Berkeley for a $100 pledge, or the combination of all of those above for $300. These are really important material. 1-800-439-5732. Please support the Project Censored Show.
That's right. Ron, who is in Forest Hill, he's offering this match. he's going to contribute money to this station for these premiums. If we can raise that same amount before this hour is over, $300 match on the table, please help out. 800-439-5732. And if you want to check out this CIA document 1035-960, I encourage you to look this up. I definitely want you to know that Peter and I don't come down here and make things up on the air. We are pretty thoroughly researched. We fact-checked our materials. We've read these premiums and these books and seen these things, and we teach these topics in college. And this is some real stuff, folks. CIA document 1035-960 concerning criticism of the Warren Report. Look it up, jfklancer.com. You can see the CIA memo talking about how to handle what they consider controversial information challenging official narratives, particularly surrounding the Kennedy assassination. This is not conspiracy theory, folks. It's conspiracy fact. 800-439-5732 is the number to call. Please keep the calls coming. We need to make that $300 match. 800-439-5732. We're going to go back and share another excerpt with you here between David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott. They're talking about the Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Talbot here is speaking again with Peter Dale Scott in a question and answer session. So we're going to play a couple of those for you now.
I'd like to sort of cast forward a little bit, ask your opinion about, you know, given where we are today with media spin, with polarization, with some people wanting us to believe that we're in a war of civilizations in this world, what advice would you give to us to try to change some of what is happening and affect positive change?
I think we have to, number one, be inspired by people like Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, people who've put their lives on the line to wake up the American people and the people of the world about the enormous growth of this surveillance state, of this national security state, and how it's undermined and sabotaged democracy throughout the world. So that's number one. Support those people who have, you know, sacrificed for us already, and fight their, for them legally and politically, and try to get them released. And I think, you know, in the process of doing that, as happened with Dan Ellsberg's case, the Pentagon Papers case, you know, during the Vietnam War, that mobilized a lot of consciousness around the war and the illegality of the war, and I think was a very important turning point in many ways. And Dan ultimately legally triumphed. So that's number one. You know, we need to sort of rally around our heroes. And those people, those three people are heroes. Number two, I think we got to get organized again. I mean, I grew up during the Vietnam War. You know, we had mass movement. We had organizations. We had people in the streets. I mean, there's nothing like that now. There was a spasm of sort of international popular, you know, ferment around the invasion of Iraq. And when that, you know, unfortunately didn't succeed, it seemed like we went back into slumber mode. I know there's been moments when, you know, that's not been true, and that we have sort of gotten our act together again. But I think it's all on all of us as American citizens at this point. You know, I mean, the country is spiraling, I think, politically out of control, frankly. I'm incredibly appalled by the 2016 presidential campaign at this point. We can laugh about it, but it really is scarier than that. And when you have these presidential candidates like Trump that are reveling and luxuriating in this, I think, fascistic rhetoric and racist rhetoric and the most obscene intolerance, that permits then all sorts of lunacy to get unhinged in this country. And believe me, I think America at this point, given all the stress that the American people are under, the economic stress, the constant war, the constant militarization of our psyches, I mean, that American Sniper is this movie that becomes our sort of, that's our American hero, this psychotic who murdered men, women, and children, and, you know, jacked up his kill rate. I mean, this country, as Martin Luther King said many years ago, is in mortal danger of losing its soul at this point, more than ever in my lifetime. So I think at this point, if nothing can get us, to push back and to start getting active, then nothing will.
That's right. That's the voice of David Talbot in conversation with Peter Dale Scott. And you heard it. That's some sobering information, some sobering advice. And boy, this talk is just full. It's chock full of those kind of wow moments in terms of untold histories. You can get this historic talk for a $75 pledge by calling 800-439-5732. Why don't you join Michelle, who called in earlier with a generous pledge. Thank you, Michelle from Oakland. Greatly appreciated your support to Free Speech Radio. Thanks to Highwire Coffee Roasters and Bacano Bakery for your support of Free Speech Radio. But again, we want to see you call in. We've got a $300 match on the table. We have 8 minutes remaining. You can get the Deep State Combo Pack for $300. You can get the CD in the book for $200. You can get the David Talbot DVD from October talk he gave in Berkeley about his book, The Devil's Chessboard, for $100. You can get the book itself for $150. Folks, it is a page-turner, almost 700 pages. You definitely want this in your collection for historical reference. You can get this audio of this historic talk in the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco with David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott for $75 pledge. And, you know, for $25, you become a voting member at KPFA. We'll send you a Project Censored bumper sticker and we'll send anything you can. Whatever you can afford is always appreciated, however large, however small. I have to say, though, for this $300, and we're talking maybe about $25 a month, you know, we're basically talking about skipping a coffee or a latte once a week, and you can get yourself into the Deep State Combo Pack, Devil's Chessboard, David Talbot, the talk with Peter Dale Scott. Pretty riveting stuff here, folks, and Peter and I are honored to bring it to you, and we'd love to see you honor our work by calling in 800-439-5732. Peter?
Alan Dulles, and he was instrumental, a primary mover in the formation of the CIA, and of course then the rise of the American secret government, which was the CIA that Eisenhower warned us about. But he was also the main mover behind the Bay of Pigs, which was the invasion of Cuba by trained Cubans who'd been in exile to try to overthrow the Castro government, which failed badly, partly because Kennedy never was fully supportive of that. And he did not provide, Dulles knew that they weren't going to be successful. So he was counting on Kennedy to back them up and send in the U.S. Marines and send in the Air Force and to be the, you know, have America, invade Cuba. That would have been a catastrophe. And that, Kennedy said no. And so Dulles never forgave him, but Dulles had lied to him. So Kennedy was outraged by that and fired Dulles. So Dulles was replaced, but he never really was replaced. He out of his own home, and then he would go out to the CIA farm, David Talbot lays all this history out. Dulles remained in charge of all the elements of the CIA that were part of his deep state mechanism, and he really engaged in that. And, in fact, he was at the CIA farm the day Kennedy was killed, fully observing what was going on and the whole practices there. That Talbot suggests that Peter Dale has proof of this. That was the American coup, a challenge to a president and then a future president, Robert Kennedy, just kill them, get rid of them. That was the deal. And so having that history, knowing the in-depth history of that is very important. So call 1-800-439-5732 to get this full package for $300 or the book for $150 or just this CD talk that you've been listening to where Peter Dale and David Talbot are together and their history, the depth of their knowledge, the depth of their understanding, their degree of research is simply amazing to have these two people on stage, a 90-minute talk addressing some of the key issues that they're most concerned about and taking it all the way up to the present.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Vandana Shiva, soil, not oil. This is the conclusion of the keynote speech by the Indian physicist, ecologist, seed collector, author, and founder of many vibrant organizations, Vandana Shiva. She had been invited to Richmond, California, for a conference that was inspired by her work. Her book, Soil Not Oil, explored the connection between climate change and industrial agriculture. Industrial agriculture is a major user of fossil fuels through the chemicals employed and fuel use in farming, food processing, and long-distance transportation. Instead of resolving hunger, industrial agriculture causes a global decline in soil fertility and leads to water depletion, since chemically grown crops require up to 10 times more water. On top of that, Shiva said, industrial crops are deficient in micronutrients while absorbing many fossil fuel toxins that we're taking in along with our food. We're literally eating oil, she said. Shiva explained how we can make a huge difference in not just curbing climate change, but even reversing some of the effects by abandoning the system of industrial agriculture across the world. Here's Vandana Shiva with a conclusion of her keynote. She begins by presenting her recent research on the data collection by the Indian government. Vandana Shiva.
We then decided last year, let's really assess what's happening with the hidden costs, external costs of chemical farming in India. And the two big costs we took into account were environmental costs. So the government does maintain data on how much soil has been eroded. They maintain data on how many bird deaths took place because of pesticide poisoning. So we took all of that data from official sources. And we added to it the data on something new we've seen as a result of the age of oil in agriculture. Farmers committing suicide. So the figures in India, according to official statistics, have crossed 300,000. The suicides began in the cotton area, and they began after Monsanto started to monopolize the cotton seed by illegal means. I have a very long article on my website on how Monsanto wrote and broke laws to dominate India's cotton supply. They collected royalties without even having a patent. The price of seed jumped 80,000%. No farmer can afford it. Debt is inevitable, and all the suicides are related to debt. But this spring, just as we were getting ready to celebrate our harvest festival in April, we had untimely rain, which is another aspect of climate change. We had hailstorms, hail that big, and the entire crop in northern India was destroyed, except in the farms that were growing native seeds and doing organic farming. And I only know this because farmers who are members of Navdanya would call me up and said, Didi, you know, in India we make everyone our relation, and I'm the elder sister. And they'd say, Didi, I used the old seeds, and my wheat is standing tall. But farmers who had been trapped into using chemicals, using the new varieties, designed to use chemicals, they're not miracle varieties. They're basically carriers of toxics. One of the things we really need to do is give up the vocabulary that's been created around seed to promote industrial agriculture. One word is primitive cultivars, they call it, primitive. And I've reached the stage where I say, you use the primitive so often for us. We are not going to say we are not primitive. We are going to say we are primitive. And if primitiveness means living in harmony with the earth, we will continue to be primitive. If to be primitive means to not be addicted to oil, we will be primitive. Because transiting beyond oil is vital to human survival. The planet will survive somehow. She'll have different life forms. She might have a different temperature. But she'll carry on. We are too small to threaten her life. But we are able, in our small-mindedness, to destroy the amazing conditions for our species that Gaia has offered us. The right temperature, the right kinds of plants. And all she asks of us in return is a little service to the soil. That's all we have to do. Give back to the soil with love. Remember, we are part of the soil, that we are the soil. And the rest she takes care of. In all these years of doing ecological agriculture, I've decided to not use the word food production. We use the word soil regeneration. Because food is a gift the earth gives back to us in return for our gift of love and labor and care, for giving back soil fertility. And that is exactly what, at the scientific level, is closing the carbon cycle. The carbon cycle has been ruptured because we are digging deep into the earth, pulling out the fossil fuels, burning them up at a very high level. And every day or year, I think it's 400 years of fossil fuel buildup. And while the earth has an amazing capacity to take the carbon dioxide emitted through natural processes and absorb it again through natural processes, the most amazing being photosynthesis, of taking the carbon dioxide out of the air, putting it in the plant, through the plant into the soil, and we join up and increase the organic matter, intensify the biodiversity, return part of it to the soil, sustain ourselves, but also sustain other species. And when we do that, the data is coming out so clear, and I'm sure Dr. Ratan Lal talked about it. We've just done a measurement of organic matter buildup on our soil in Doon Valley, where I come from, and where I've built up the Navdanya farm. And I'm so happy to be with you, but I must tell you, we are in the middle of a one-month training on the A to Z of agroecology and organic farming. And I started it off, I took the first 2 days of classes, and the fact that I'm spending as much time as I am in California, and first with you for Soil Not Oil, and then at the Heirloom Expo, is I just feel you in California have such a vital role to play today. Not just for California and not just for the U.S., but the world. I could very, very happily just, you know, be at the farm, do wonderful things, interact with people from Indonesia and Korea and all over the world who are there to build this movement. But you are in a very, very special moment in space and time. In terms of time, of course, you know, you're at the heart of the drought expression of the climate crisis. Right here in Richmond, we are at the heart of an oil empire. And I know that is the reason Miguel picked Richmond as the place for this conference. But you are also at the heart of democracy in a moment when democracy is dying and being killed very deliberately, particularly around agriculture, industrial agriculture, and its next generation of industrializing life itself through genetic engineering, and of course, through oil. Just look, I mean, make a map of the Middle East today and look at all the interventions. What were they for? Regime change is an excuse. It was for oil. But there are much nicer ways we can relate to carbon, to living carbon rather than dead carbon, to green carbon rather than black carbon. I personally get very troubled when the language starts to grow, we've got to decarbonize the economy. The G8 put out its statement this year about decarbonization. I said, you know, if you took it seriously, we'd all be dead. Because we are carbon, our plants are carbon. You cannot decarbonize life which is made of carbon. And John wrote such a wonderful piece on recarbonizing the soil while we decarbonize the parts of our lives where we don't need fossil carbon. Not in energy, not in transport, we can do much better. So we've been just giving back to the earth in every way we can. And one of the things that I haven't managed to really measure yet, but I see it every day on our farm. The dwarf varieties of the Green Revolution hardly give you any organic matter and therefore block your return of carbon. Older varieties are that tall. The millet varieties are huge. We have saved a rice variety that grows 18 feet tall in the floodwaters of Bihar. And of course, Bill Gates, who loves to work to promote Monsanto, has just written a piece, which my colleague Ruchi was sharing with me, saying how he is bringing to Bihar, through innovation, flood-tolerant rices. You cannot genetically engineer flood tolerance. You cannot genetically engineer drought tolerance. You cannot genetically engineer salt tolerance. These are complex traits where many genes act together. Genetic engineering is such a crude technology, it can only introduce one gene through a gene gun. It is not able to understand the relationships of the entire genome in all its complexity and all its capacity to self-organize and self-regulate. So with organic farming, the measures in Doon Valley on our organic farms are 2.2 tons per hectare. The figures are available now that with a 2 tons per hectare increase in organic matter, which I call it a thank you to the earth and the soil. It's just our thank you for supporting us. We could pull out 10 gigatons from the atmosphere. Through organic farming, we don't just reduce the 40% greenhouse gases we've pumped up. We do more. We pull out the stocks that have accumulated. Now, there are two figures that buzz around in the climate discussion. One is 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent, and the other is 2 degrees centigrade, that beyond 2 degrees centigrade, which will be inevitable if we go beyond 350, climate chaos and climate catastrophe will be inevitable. Of course, as I was saying, we already are witnessing climate chaos and climate catastrophes. It's already taking lives. But that number is normally just referred to in the abstract. And if we leave it to corrupt governments who for 21 conference of parties, you know, the Paris meeting, the 21st conference of party, they've had 21 occasions to commit themselves to solving the problem. 21 times they have failed the planet and people. When such an easy path is available to reach that 2 degree limit. They're still saying it'll be very difficult. Well, it's very difficult if all you have to do is oblige yourself to the oil industry and the biotech industry. But it's not difficult at all if we say, if each of us commits ourselves, that whatever is the land on which our lives depend, either directly as gardeners or directly as farmers or indirectly through the food we eat, we are going to make sure that our living on this planet returns to the earth the carbon that belongs to her. And the beauty of it is, it doesn't just address the climate crisis. It addresses the health crisis, which is coming from eating oil. It addresses the crisis of other aspects of the ecological problem, the water crisis, the desertification, the biodiversity extinction and erosion. But I think most of all, it allows us to reclaim Earth democracy. It allows us to play an active role to truly deserve the citizenship of this beautiful planet. So when I talk about soil, not oil, I'm really talking about the birthing of an Earth democracy. A birthing of an Earth democracy with us celebrating what Richard Heinberg has called the powering down in terms of fossil fuel, shedding that extra baggage that has been imposed on us through illusion after illusion after illusion. And while we power down in fossil fuels, we power up in our own capacities to make change, our capacity to live better by consuming less of the earth. And, you know, since I am in a part of the world which has deep poverty as well as huge wealth, and I also work with the government of Bhutan on this transition to 100% organic Bhutan. And Bhutan has said, we will not measure GDP, which is also a part of this age of oil. Because the age of oil, very cleverly said, the more you destroy nature and turn it into commodities, the more growth you have. The more you destroy society and its ability to provide for itself and make it dependent on buying its junk food, it's bottled water, the more growth you have. The more sick the people are, and the more drugs have to be bought from the same companies that also gave us the sickness through the poisons. We mustn't forget that those who want to control the seed today are the same industries that have been the ones pushing poisons in farming, the agrochemicals, and are the same companies that made those chemicals for war. That agriculture has become a war against the planet and our bodies is not an accident. Its origins are war. And the new birthing we have to do very consciously, very collectively, in solidarity, not just amongst ourselves, but across species. And that's the beauty of our time. That while cultures have existed, my own culture gave me the word Vasudheva Kutumbakam, the earth has a family. Chief Seattle said, we are part of the web of life, not outside it. Pachamama, no matter where you look in the world, cultures realize we were part of the earth family. The age of oil for 250 years has tried to make us forget it. We can remember again that we are the soil, and start working with the soil. Now, it's not that the transition will be immediate, will be easy, will not have interruptions. The two big hijacks that are taking place right now of the recognition that agriculture has to be part of the discussions on climate change are coming from Monsanto, my dear friend. So Monsanto has given us two big new myths. One is they've literally taken over the abbreviation CSA, which you all created for community-supported agriculture, and they've made it an abbreviation of Climate Smart Agriculture. And Climate Smart is smart only in their sense, but it's reflecting something that even The Economist, which, you know, forever has promoted the Monsanto perspective, It has an article in the issue that I was reading in the plane, and it's talking about Monsanto's attempt to buy Syngenta, which failed, is part of its collapse of being able to bring anything beyond Roundup and Roundup ready crops. They're stuck. They are totally stuck. And this is what the article says. Monsanto's purchases in recent years of several firms that provide farmers with detailed data on local soil and climate conditions are just a cover-up for the fact that their core markets have saturated. Monsanto's bought up Climate Corporation, and the film on living soil would have shown you that graph of Monsanto's future projections, and they have bought Solem, the soil analysis, the biggest soil analysis corporation. So now that they failed on selling the miracle of genetic engineering as the next step of industrial agriculture, they want to sell big data as their next step. And there have been analysis saying big data means big brains. No, big data means empty brains. Because real brains work with ecosystems, with life, with the soil, and with the seed. And the new knowledge that's coming about how every little root hair in the soil is the neuron of the plant communicating all the time with the living soil. How in our gut are this amazing microbiome, which is being killed by the Roundup and the Roundup ready crops. That the Roundup is killing all the beneficial organisms in the soil and then leading to pathogenic organisms. That is being empty-brained. To not realize that health of the soil and our health comes from the living diversity, both within us and on the planet. So as the age of oil ends, and it won't end by itself, we'll have to work with a lot of love, a lot of compassion, a lot of hope, but a lot of fun and a lot of joy. It's time to stop thinking of climate change through fear. It's time to start thinking of climate change as an opportunity the earth has given us to return to our roots, to return to the soil. And as more and more of us make that shift, the age of oil will be unstoppable. I will leave you with a quotation from one of our ancient Vedas, which we have quoted in Terra Viva, the manifesto on our soil, our commons, our future. A new vision for planetary citizenship. This new vision is also an ancient vision. And the Vedas say, upon this handful of soil, our survival depends. Husband it, and it will grow our food, our fuel, and our shelter, and surround us with beauty. Abuse it, and the soil will collapse and die, taking humanity with it. We should be around as a species 2,000 years down the line, for people to say, in time, our ancestors woke up. Thank you.
That was the inspiring finale of the keynote address by the Indian ecologist, physicist, and seed collector, Vandana Shiva. She spoke at the Soil Not Oil Conference in Richmond, California, on September 4, 2015. She's the author of many books, among them Earth Democracy, Monoculture of the Mind, The Violence of the Green Revolution, and Making Peace with the Earth. Vandana Shiva attended the COP21 conference in Paris, and you will hear an interview with her when TUC Radio returns. Here's a brief preview.
There's a convention on biological diversity. There's a convention on climate change. There's a third convention on desertification. I've been asked by the UN to repeatedly address the connections between these three. And frankly, the one that I hold most promise for is the desertification convention, because it's such a dismal situation that no cooperation is there. So that's where the truth comes out of how we are desertifying our soils, how out of that a refugee crisis is coming, how out of that conflicts are coming. Both Syria and Boko Haram are born of desertification. And then the processes that destroy the soil then also emit the greenhouse gases and come back and create extended drought. So we have to start thinking systemically, and that's one thing I hope for. The second thing I hope for is a recognition that industrial agriculture is the single biggest cause for climate change. We know 85% deforestation is for expansion of industrial monocultures, of palm oil, of soya, into the Amazon, into the Indonesian rainforest. We know food miles are increasing. We know synthetic fertilizers emit nitrogen oxide that is 300 times more destabilizing for the climate than carbon dioxide. We know factory farms are a major source of methane. And we definitely need to focus both on the damage industrial farming is doing, as well as the solutions that come with ecological agriculture. Because not only can ecological agriculture stop the emissions, it also is able to remove the stocks that are built up. It's the only activity. Only living systems can. And that is what industry is scared of, that people with living systems can do a better job. Now, agriculture is the only place where reducing emissions also gives you a better life. So no one can pretend to say, oh my God, my people will have to eat organic food.
Vandana Shiva, recorded in the creative bustle of the famous Place to Be. Place to Be was a place to sleep, to exchange and debate COP21 and beyond, and a place to share thoughts, talks, views, films, concerts, etc. Come back for the full interview when TUC Radio returns, as well as a surprise guest from Canada on the topic of that revolution in agriculture and land use. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The rediscovery of native cultures in our countries, because these cultures are dangerous from the point of view of the owners of power, Why? Well, because of community and communion. Community as a different, another different way of life, not centered on greed, but on solidarity. And communion, when I say communion, I'm meaning communion with nature.
That's the voice of Eduardo Galeano. Eduardo Galeano was a Uruguayan journalist, writer, and novelist, and a literacy giant of the left. Eduardo Galeano wrote such books as The Open Veins of Latin America, The Upside Down World, and his latest book, Mirrors. On April 13th, 2015, he passed away and we lost an icon. On this week's show, we play an interview we did with Eduardo Galeano from 2009, which is still very relevant today. Stay tuned.
It is a great privilege to have on our show the poet Eduardo Galeano. His latest book, Mirrors, speaks of the stories of almost everyone, a collection of vignettes that depicts the breadth of human history. What a wonderful book, known throughout Latin America for his groundbreaking book in 1971, The Open Veins of Latin America, an indictment of the plunder of the region by European and U.S. imperialists. Poeta, welcome to our show, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and thank you for giving me this title of poet. I feel proud of it, because I'm afraid I don't deserve it. I write in prose, not in verse. But perhaps, being, as I feel I am, a loyal interpreter, translator of reality, perhaps I am also doing poetry, even if I don't know I'm doing so, like that character of Molière was speaking prose and he didn't know.
You are correct to acknowledge the title of poet. For me, I think in terms of a poet as someone who is able to inspire a sentiment that moves people, that steers our feelings inside, that goes beyond our intellectual capacity to see and inform or receive information, but goes to our feelings, our ability to experience the sentiment that unites us, the something that moves us, the something that we are more than just intellectual beings, but rather I think a poet has the ability to convey a message in a way that inspires people to do something about it.
Okay, I feel proud of it. I hope I deserve such an honorable title. You are very generous anyway. Thank you very much. All I want to do is to try to see the unseen, the other side of the moon, the other side of the earth, and perhaps this is in some ways an act of poetry. Perhaps, yes.
There are events in life that can have a long-lasting impression and can sometimes be part of a defining moment in our lives. And sometimes that experience can come from a book. Many writers write with intent to convey information, sometimes to denounce acts of injustice. I think the book Open Veins of Latin America has had a special place in the consciousness of people in Latin America as it opened our eyes and offered a language of indignation against the plunder of the region by European and U.S. imperialists. It became one of the best-selling books in the Amazon.com charts. How should people read your book, Open Veins of Latin America?
For me, in my personal life, the Open Veins of Latin America was a port of departure, not a port of arrival. I mean, it was my first real book, inspired by the intention of showing the other side of reality, the unknown past, the unknown history, not as a homage to the past, but just as a way to trying to help a little to change reality. The first step to begin changing reality is to try to see it as it is. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to change it. And I think the book may have helped to awake conscience all over Latin America and even in the United States and other countries in this sense. But afterwards, I wrote many other books with the same intention, but written in a quite different way. Open Veins is a classic essay. It's inside the genre of literary essays. But afterwards, I tried to invent a different language, short texts, as you said, mixing all the literary genres in a single synthesis, perhaps a poetic synthesis, trying to recover reality in all the sides of it, not only political economy, because Open Veins is mainly a book about the history seen from this point of view, the political economy point of view. And on the other books I wrote, several books, up to the last one, Mirrors, an almost universal history, as the title says, with a certain humor, I tried to show other sides of reality, not only the political economy. I mean, not only exploitation, not only horrors, but also the feast of lies in all its diversity, because the best of the world is the many worlds that are inside each world.
We often talk about the importance of creating communities that are diverse, pluralistic, and inclusive. But our societies operate under a system of capitalism that completely denies the role of diversity. It actually advocates for a homogeneous, consumption-based, individualistic society that maximizes individual profits at the expense of others. So how do we create a more egalitarian and inclusive society? What are the barriers that we need to overcome?
You know, the problem, especially in Latin America, but not only in Latin America, also in the other America, North America, the United States, is that our countries were born from a big lie. Since the beginning, it was a denial of our diversity. And this was perfectly well translated by the first constitutions, which denied the rights to almost all the population. For instance, my own country, Uruguay, the first constitution in 1830 gave the right to be a citizen only one person out of 10. And in the first elections, 95% of the population did not vote. And this is also true for all the Americas. The first constitution in the United States established that a black woman or a black man was equivalent to 3/5 part of a person. When I see that this intention of President Zelaya in Honduras to change the constitution as an alibi for the coup of Etat, a possible explanation for the military coup, I think about the United States, for instance. What would happen there in the United States if with the same constitution, with the first one, Barack Obama wouldn't be able to be the president because he would be considered the 3/5 parts of a person. And the same thing about all the other American countries. Bolivia, for instance, the first constitution of Bolivia gave civil rights to the 3% of the population, denying the fact that Bolivia was and is still a country made up mostly of Indians. This revelation of the true identity, diverse and with a vast majority of Indian population, the revelation occurred in 3 years ago. It took centuries to rediscover Bolivia. And it happened when Evo Morales, which is an Aymara Indian, was selected president by an avalanche of votes.
That's such an important point, this rich diversity of culture and heritage of indigenous people has been hidden from our historical context. In Canada, we have an indigenous population that until some 20, 30 years ago were not even able to vote, were not even considered human in our recent history. We have residential schools that were predominantly designed to put an end to the cultural and language heritage of indigenous people in Canada. And to this day, we have a government that has not recognized the rights of indigenous people. Why is the history of indigenous people so threatened to the capitalist system and to most governments worldwide that is kept deliberately hidden from a cultural history of societies?
The problem is that nowadays the central power in the world impose over all the countries a single possible way of life. And this way of life, well, is a mixing of violence and pollution. Each baby being born with a gun in one hand and a steering wheel in the other, wars and cars, violence and pollution, as a single possible way of life. And I think, siento y pienso, that this is the explanation for the very, very difficult recognition of diversity and, for instance, the very, very difficult of the rediscovery of native cultures in our countries. Because these cultures are dangerous from the point of view of the owners of power. Why? Well, because of community and communion. Community as a different, another different way of life, not centered on greed, but on solidarity. And communion, when I say communion, I'm meaning communion with nature. All these native cultures, unbelievably alive, after more than five centuries of denying and chasing and crime, it's a sort of a miracle. They could keep alive their central value, which is the community of life and the community in the communion with nature, the certainty that we are members of the same family. Not only we have legs, but also all those brothers and sisters who have branches or wings. And that's why it's so important that in Ecuador last year, the new constitution recognized for the first time in all history of humanity the rights of nature. It was the first time. It took who knows how many millenniums to obtain this recognition in a constitution. Nature as a source of rights. And this comes very deeply inside from the Indian culture of Ecuador. This is the source of the source.
To the extent that we have separated ourselves from nature and lost that sense of communion with nature, we see it as a commodity, something that can be caught, burned, spoiled, soiled, sold for profit. We are not only destroying nature, but also destroying ourselves in the process as we pollute our water, our food supply, in this very myopic view of the world through the eyes of the economy, through the eyes of profit-making. Many have pointed to education as a way to begin the transformation of our societies. We can restore a more sustainable way of life by educating people. Can education save us? What kind of education? So far, the education we've had has been one that teaches us about domination, the ability of some to rule over others. What is needed to create transformative change? Is education enough?
Well, you know, education itself is not enough, because we should begin asking what sort of education are we receiving. If it's a real education in which the teachers teach but also learn teaching, we wouldn't arrive really to offer to the new generations a real image of another possible world. And of course, education itself has its limitations. You know, the old proverb has it that teaching fishing is better than handing out fish. But there is a bishop who is also a poet, Pedro Casaldáliga, in Brazil, living in the Amazon, that he says, well, yes, this is correct, a very good thought, a very good intention. But then he asks, but suppose someone buys the river that had belonged to all, and this someone outlaws fishing, or suppose toxic waste pollutes the river and poisons the fish. In other words, suppose what happens is what is happening right now. And I share this point of view, this dangerous question by Bishop Casaldáliga.
The idea that violence and poverty are natural occurrences. We live in a world that seems to have perpetual violence and poverty everywhere you look. And there are some geographical areas that are poor and that there seems to be nothing to be done about it. And the violence seems to be also a natural phenomenon. What is your opinion of this?
This is a system saying days and nights that we are doomed to go on exterminating each other. And I don't share this conviction, because this conviction is not honest at all. It is born from the military industry. This is a world, an upside-down world, which consecrates the best energies and the most important economic resources to the production of death. Each minute, 15 babies are being killed by a system which denies them food or medicines. Each minute, 15 children killed by this system, which at the same time, during the same minute, is spending $3 million in the industry of killing, in the industry of death, in the military industry. $3 million per minute. So the world is organized in such a way that we may all begin asking this obvious question. Wouldn't it be much better if we work for life and now for death? Let death do her job. It's very well done already, but let's stop helping her.
Thank you so much for being with us. Poet Eduardo Galeano's latest book is Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone. Poeta Galeano, muchísimas gracias por estar con nosotros. It's been a real pleasure having you on our show. Un abrazo.
Un abrazo.
Un abrazo. Muchísimas gracias. Muchísimas gracias.
Bueno, chao.
Hasta pronto. Chao.
Thanks for listening. We're going to finish our show with a song by Dana Lyons called The Green and Blue. Bye for now.
have traveled far and seen the magic of this place so far away. Halfway round the world, so far from you. Ancient dancing trees, blown to perfection by a thousand years of wind. Giant rivers fall from a lake so blue. It's hard to understand. They dam a river with the glaciers almost gone. As if nothing's wrong, we march on through. Lovers in a time, the word forever is a question on the wind. 12 billion hands begin what we must do, and that is why, my love, we hold a candle. We pass the mantle with our children's ancient right to green and blue. We rise up once again. We may not live to see the dawn after the end. Let's take a moment now to savor. Don't start to cry, or I'll cry too. Life will find a way, our poison prison slowly swept into the sea. Sacredness survives, and we will. That is why, my love, we hold a candle to the eminence of night. We pass the mantle with our children's ancient right to green and blue. We rise up once again, born with knowledge that the dawn will come again. Let's take a moment now to savor this, my friend. The green and forget that there are children everywhere, cuddling ragged bears, where dreams come true. Deep beneath we know that we are better than this mess we have become.
reach for the horse, and I'll lift you. And that is why, my love, we hold a candle to the eminence of night. We pass the mantle with our children's ancient right. Rise up once again. We may not live to see the dawn after the end. Let's take a moment now to savor this, my friend. The green and
come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.